not a holiday. I think it was a short constituency period, because I know that most of us were doing our work out there. And hopefully you did also find some time to be with the family, because that's the most important part of who we are. You ignore that element, you become a social problem for us, because when we can't find you, we've got no way to trace you. So at least if we know that you have got a family, you've got a home, if we can't find you, phone home and tell us whether you came back or not.
Future.
We want to hear that family value. we have our visitors today here. They look very fresh, unlike some of us, our eyes are still red. Those are honorable members who don't want to sleep in Cape Town on Mondays. They come on Tuesday morning, so they don't sleep effectively. The co-pilot from wherever they are. But we have the GEPF, one of the most important institutions in this country. And I must say, their work, to a certain extent, is beginning to touch on the discussions that are happening out there in the public discourse in terms of policy discussion documents of the ruling party, I must say. And I've heard banks saying, prescribed assets this, prescribed assets that, this is what it will cost, this is what it will mean. That's not the subject of the day. We are more interested in understanding to what extent are they looking after this asset in terms of their strategic annual plans. As you know, that their chair is one of us, Honorable Muloto, but he is here in his capacity as the chair. I must just indicate and clarify that upfront. Last week, we had a little bit of a misunderstanding that when we're meeting with the PIC, the deputy minister comes into this meeting as the chair of the PIC, not as the deputy minister, although that's the title that he has. Now, Honorable Muloto, if I refer you to you as the chair, don't think that you are equal to me in this meeting. You are not the chair here. Okay. And we have the CEO of GEPF, Ntate Oliphant, John Oliphant. I would hand over to you, Chair. You will guide us on how you want to handle your presentation, and probably the team that is here should be introduced. I've already recognized one colleague that I worked with for many years in the finance family. At the time was in Northwest, head of finance. So over to you, but you are all welcome. We hope we'll have a very, very interesting engagement with yourself. And as always, looking forward to have programs that we can support in Parliament on our side. Thank you very much. Over to you, Dr. Muloto.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for the warm reception and introduction. With me is the Deputy Chairperson of the Board, Mr. Rabir Badal. And on my left is the Acting Principal Officer and Head of Investment, Mr. John Oliphant. On the other right is Ms. Jolene Moodley, the Head of Corporate Services in GPF. Next to her is Ms. Adrifan Nikerk, the Head of Secretariat. Chairperson, we would know, as we have briefed you in your last visit to the GPF, that we have separated from our administration agency. We have invited the CEO of the administration agency to be with us, together with the COO, Ms. Mantin Tikula. You know, as most of you know, the CEO of CHIPA, Mr. Chia. Chairperson and honorable members of Parliament, it's indeed a great pleasure and privilege to be back in Parliament to brief the Committee on the Strategic Plans of the GEPF. As always, we value the interaction we have in Parliament. We draw inspiration and encouragement from this fruitful engagement that we have with this committee. As you may know, the GEPF assets have surpassed the 1 trillion mark, making it the largest pension fund in Africa by far. It's a daunting task, and we believe that we have got a huge impact on the South African economy, and that conviction we carry with humility, and believe that we have got a responsibility to manage this strategic national interest, exercising our fiduciary responsibility with utmost diligence and care, while we remain humble and open to engagement with all stakeholders. It is this humility and acknowledgement of our size in the South African economy that has made us to adopt one of the most progressive policies on investment, that is the Developmental Investment Policy. The GEPF Developmental Investment Policy was developed in consultation with stakeholders, guided by research and sound investment principles. Chairperson, we had engagement with this committee last year, and in that engagement, members of Parliament expressed concerns around us having excellent policies, but falling short on the implementation. We have taken that criticism into consideration, and we believe that this is a trap that we are mindful of, and we have responded, working together with our key service provider, the PIC. We have a new framework for implementation of the DI policy and other unlisted investments, which is more enhanced in terms of governance, risk management, and ability to attract the best talent. We believe this model will take the GEPF to greater success going forward. I'm informed, Chairperson, that this committee had an engagement with the PIC last week, and that the PIC shared with you this model. But as the architects of the model, we will be more than willing to address any questions that the committee may have regarding the revised model for unlisted investment. Secondly, Chairperson, you did, when we appeared before this committee in 2010, you did express certain concerns around our capabilities when it comes to pension management. And the newly established GEPA, born out of GPF, we are happy to say that it's continuing well with the modernization program, which is aimed at improving services to our members and pensioners. As part of the modernization, GEPA has introduced an automated life verification process which interfaces with Home Affairs database to verify whether the pensioner is still alive. In the past, it was a tedious exercise which required pensioners to go to a police station and fill a form which would certify that they are still alive and then go to the GPF office and submit. Well, we believe that was cumbersome, and for the dignity of our pensioners, we have made significant progress in coming up with this automated life verification process. And therefore, it's no longer a requirement that the pensioners should submit life certificates. Chairperson, without wasting much time, I'm going to hand over to the Acting Principal Officer and Head of Investment of GEPF, Mr. John Oliphant, to take us through the presentation.
Yeah, for record purposes, thank you, Chairperson. I referred to Mr. John Oliphant as the CEO earlier on. To make sure that we are consistent in terms of your title.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. It is indeed a great pleasure for us to be standing here in Parliament to share with you the key strategic initiatives of the GEPF. We have prepared the presentation in line with the agenda we received from your administration office, and understanding that we had about 30 minutes to go through some of the important elements of the GEPF. In terms of our agenda, we're going to go a bit into the background, the legislative mandate, go to our vision and mission, discuss a little bit about our operating model, and then we'll touch on the GEPF strategic objectives and our performance against those objectives, and then also talk a little bit about the resources that we have allocated to ensure that we are able to achieve the strategic objectives that were set by the GEPF board. In terms of the GEPF chairperson, I'm proud to announce that our assets are sitting at about 1,043 billion, and that was as of 29 February 2012. I've seen the market has been responding positively, and I think as of 31 March, which is our year end, we will still be above 1 trillion, but however, our auditors are still busy auditing the GEPF assets. In terms of members, we've got about 1.2 million active members who are the current employees of government, nurses, teachers, policemen, and others. And then we've got about 342 pensioners and beneficiaries. In terms of governance, Chairperson, the board is governed by a board of trustees, which is a 16-member board, and then we also have 16 substitutes in case a board member cannot make it to a board meeting. And it's a broad representative board in a sense that we've got eight employer representatives on the board. The eight employer representatives on the board gets nominated or appointed by the Minister of Finance on behalf of government in consultation with other departments within government. And then we've got seven employee representatives, which predominantly come through the PSCBC, where most of our union sit and negotiate with government. And the deputy chairperson of the board is also one of the employer representatives as the treasurer of NEHAU. And then we also have a one pensioner representative, so pensioners also have a voice on the board. They elect one candidate amongst themselves who will sit on the board to serve on the board on behalf of the GPM. In terms of our legislative mandate, the fund was set up to provide the pensions and certain other related benefits, and all of it is detailed in the GEP law of 1996. The fund is a juristic entity, and I must say that we are not one of the entities that report in terms of PFMA. All the requirements of the GEPF in relation to how we prepare our financial statements and so forth, they are all detailed in the GEP law. And then the Board of Trustees, in this case, is the executive authority. And then from time to time, the financial statements of the GPF gets tabled in Parliament by the Minister of Finance on behalf of the fund. In terms of the responsibilities of the board, they are responsible for an effective and efficient administration of the fund, and that is Section 7 of the law. Financial reporting and audit arrangements, which is in Section 9 and 10 of the law. The funding level of the fund. As you know, that most people talk about GEPF as 1 trillion and so forth, but often they never talk about the liabilities of the fund. Chairperson, the liabilities of the fund of the GEPF surpassed the 1 trillion mark last year, September. So it's important that we ensure that the assets get invested well so that the fund remains sustainable in the long term. Obviously, communication with members is an important element, and to some extent we have outsourced this through an SLA to JEPA. And then also investments of the assets are such that we invest all the money in line with an investment policy of the fund, which the board has to develop in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And I'm glad that this process, we've gone through it, and that's why we've started new initiatives around our investment mandate, especially introducing other elements. And then also financial arrangements, pension increases. For example, you know that the GPF declared a 4.8% increase this year, which is in line with the requirements of the law of ensuring that the pension increases are in line with inflation. The law requires the board to maintain increases at a minimum of 75% of inflation to the extent that is affordable. So it's a balancing act between the funding level as well as the affordability. So those elements need to be played together. Chairperson, our vision as the GPF, we see ourselves, given to our size, we set a high target of wanting to be a role model of pension funds worldwide. You know that the GPF is the largest pension fund in Africa, and I think it's ranked about number 6 or 7 globally. So it's seen as one of the largest pension funds worldwide, and it's important that we continue to strive for excellence even in the global arena. In terms of our mission, which has mainly been inspired by the law, is that we want to ensure the timely and efficient delivery of benefits that have been provided for in the rules and protect the pensions against inflation to the maximum extent affordable while maintaining the financial soundness of the fund. We also take our responsibility around investments very seriously, and therefore we've said in our mission that we want to invest in a way that we are able to engage with entities in which we invest around good governance, social equity, and environmental practices. As you know, that one of the greatest challenges in the current generation of human beings is the issue of climate change, and it's one of the issues that we're actively involved in ensuring that our investments are sustainable in the long term. We also, in our mission, want to empower our members and pensioners and other stakeholders through adequate communication. And then this is an area that we think we still have some weaknesses, but we're building capacity to ensure that we are able to communicate and also educate our members in relation to their pension benefits. I think myself as a youngster and many of us, we often forget about our pension savings. We only worry about that when we are about to retire. And that in most instances is almost late. So it's important that our education drive going forward focuses on the ability of people to save so that they've got adequate money for retirement. We also want to champion retirement industry initiatives, and we've been doing this through many initiatives, and we'll share with you in our strategy. Chairperson, I think at the outset it's important for us to set our framework, indicate how we operate. You would see that the GEPF, which is the Government Employees Pension Fund, under the leadership of Mr. Molote, the chairperson, our role is mainly to set strategy and policy. And then in terms of implementation, we've outsourced the administration to the Government Pension Administration Agency under the leadership of Mr. Chie. And then most of our investments have been delegated to PIC through an investment mandate. And obviously, both institutions report to us on a quarterly basis. We engage robustly around the strategy. We review whether we are still in line with what we had set to achieve. And we believe that so far the model has been working well in relation to the GPF. In terms of the strategic objectives of the fund, we've got five key strategic objectives, most of which are related to our mission as well. We are saying that we want to remain a leader in responsible investing. We want to develop capability to be a one-stop financial services that offers its members and pensioners improved and flexible benefits. We also want to optimize the fund structure in terms of governance and the benefits that are offered to members. And if you look at those, the top three strategic objectives, they are trendsetters in relation to being a role model of pension funds worldwide. And for you to be able to be a trendsetter, you need to attract the best employees. Hence, our fourth strategic objective of being an employer of choice is important to us, so that as a fund, we are able to establish a well-competent team that can deliver on our strategy. And then lastly, we want to establish, and I think the establishment weight is important because we believe and we'll share with you that our credibility can still be improved upon. So that's why we say we want to establish and maintain credibility with all key stakeholders, including Parliament. So those are the five key strategic objectives of the GEPF. So in relation to the first strategic objective of being a leader in responsible investing, some of the GEPF's initiatives is that we've continued to align the GEPF assets to outperform the liabilities. GEPF is one of the leading institutions in Africa and one of the pioneers of a liability-driven investment approach. So we never want to shoot out the lights, so you'll never see us making headlines to say we've outperformed so-and-so. Our job is to outperform the liabilities of the fund. I've indicated that the liabilities of the fund, which is the promises that we have made to our members and pensioners, when you sum them up in actuarial terms, they are already above 1 trillion. So it's important that we sustain our assets, we continue to grow them, even under the difficult economic environment. And then secondly, we continue to play a meaningful role in positioning responsible investing as a mainstream in the local market as well as the international market. You would know that the debates around socially responsible investing and so forth over the years has been transformed from being a peripheral investment approach to becoming mainstream. Hence, the GEPF was one of the first signatories to the UNPRI, and then also we were the first institution in Africa to launch a responsible investment policy. And then secondly, we've continued to chair the UNPRI South African Network. We're also serving on the UNPRI board in ensuring that at the global level we position responsible investing as mainstream. And then we also championed the code for responsible investing in South Africa. And then thirdly, the chairperson of the board referred to the new model for unlisted investments. You would know that we've got an ambitious program in the developmental investments, and you would know invariably when you've got an unlisted portfolio, you have to have proper governance structures, you have to have proper accountability and so forth. So the GPF board adopted a new model for unlisted investments and as a way to transform what was formerly known as the easy buyer portfolio to ensure that there's greater accountability and also we are able to achieve the objectives as set out. And we believe that such a model has already been shared with Parliament by the PIC. And then obviously, Chairperson, we continue to engage with investee companies on ESG issues. ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social and Governance, we always engage with entities to ensure that they are sustainable going forward. Just to give you a high-level Chairperson of...
I suspect there's a cell phone which is on here. And it's interfering.
My phones are off.
Yeah. For in case you've forgotten, just make sure. Including yours, Carol.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Just going back, I mean, I said that the GPF is one of the, you know, pioneers of liability-driven investment approach. And this slide, to some extent, Chairperson, I think it summarizes you know, the approach that we use in arriving at a strategic asset allocation for the GPF. If you look at the left, with the, that's the area where the GPF board does not have a discretion. It's something that is prescribed in the law, and that determines the liability structure of the fund. When you go on the green side on the right, that's where the GPF board has a discretion, obviously in consultation with the Minister of Finance, as the requirement of Section 6-7 of the law, where they can say what structure should the portfolio follow such that we are able to optimize our chances of achieving the objectives of the fund. And then obviously, Chairperson, we go through an ALM exercise, which we optimize this, and then arrive at a strategic asset allocation as detailed at the next slide. This strategic asset allocation was agreed to in consultation with the Minister of Finance. I think that was in December 2010. Or earlier, and then we started transitioning the portfolio to achieve a greater diversification. So you would see that going forward, the GPF would have an allocation of about 5% towards Africa, excluding South Africa, which is an element that we were not in before. It will have an exposure to foreign equity of about 3%, while maintaining a very significant exposure in the South African market. You would see in this level, you would not necessarily would not see the DI portfolio and so forth, because we are looking at it at an asset class level. But if you go to the next slide, you'll start realizing that our developmental investment policy, which I think has been handed out, is inserted inside the annual report, will impact on all asset classes. So we'll do developmental investments within equity portfolio, we'll have developmental investments within the fixed income portfolio, we'll have developmental investments within the property portfolio, and we'll have developmental investment within the African context going forward. But I must say it's going to be a long-term journey, because when you talk about unlisted opportunities, they don't come every day, so we believe that this portfolio will take us a very long time to build to ensure that we are able to achieve our strategic objectives. Chairperson, I think it's important to clarify what we mean by developmental investing, because I think many people tend to think developmental investing is about sacrifice of returns. Our research shows that there are a lot of investment opportunities that can generate excellent investment returns while at the same time having a positive impact on society. So if you look at the four quadrants that we have, you can see that we believe that government has a role to play, DFIs have their role to play, charity organizations have their role to play, but the GPF is more positioned to playing on the right-hand side. If you take the X-axis, that gives you the financial returns. So being on the right side of the X-axis, you're obviously generating positive returns. And then being at the top quadrant, you're obviously generating high impact on society. That's where we see the GPF portfolio being positioned. And we've seen examples of these excellent investments that generate the impact that we are looking for, but at the same time diversifying the portfolio and also generating excellent investment returns. Chairperson, based on that framework, we've identified four pillars that we believe the GPF will be able to develop sustainable investment returns and have a high impact on society. Economic infrastructure is the first pillar of our strategy, and I think when you talk about economic infrastructure, it's important to talk about the actual impact of underinvestment in economic infrastructure. Chairperson, I think it's still very fresh in our minds what happened in 2007 in relation to power supply in South Africa. You would remember 2006, 2007, that's when we started experiencing serious shortages of power. And what happened is that most of the mining entities were forced to shut down their aluminium smelters, and that had a massive impact on our equity portfolio in terms of returns. So you can see that an underinvestment in economic infrastructure can result in a high or negative impact on our portfolio of assets. And hence, that's why we believe economic infrastructure presents excellent investment opportunities for us, but at the same time, it will have a secondary impact on our equity portfolio in putting it on a sustainable path for growth going forward. Social infrastructure forms the second pillar of our strategy, and this is where we're going to look at affordable housing in terms of investment opportunities. I would give you a very good example here. If you take the government employees, the current employees in government, I often say that collectively they are the richest South Africans, but individually they are poor because most of our people, they cannot afford houses, not because that they don't have the ability to attract credit or get bond funding, but because the market does not supply houses that they can afford. So we saw that as an investment opportunity where we can play in an area of developing houses that are in the, that people that earn around 7,500 or 10,000 a month can afford. So those opportunities will arise, and I think we've given you some few examples of those investment opportunities. Environmental sustainability, I did indicate that climate change is one of the greatest challenges. I mean, I often laugh and say that, you know, we've just invested in waterfront, and scientists predict that if nothing is done by climate change, by 2030, 2040, the waterfront will be underwater. So it's very important as a risk management and mitigation to ensure that we take environmental issues into account. But at the same time, we also have to pursue investment opportunities because, you know, to transition the South African economy from being brown to being green will require investment capital, and we see a whole lot of investment opportunities in that area. And then the last pillar of our strategy is job creation and new enterprises. And here we're looking for investment opportunities in small, micro, and medium enterprises. And we have good opportunities. I often use MTN as an example. I don't know if it's something that we want to use in this forum, but MTN, you know, or Vodacom or Cell C, those entities never existed 20 years ago. But today, they are multi and global organizations that employ thousands of jobs but generate excellent investment returns. And those are type of opportunities that we think at GPF we need to pursue to ensure that we can sustainably grow the GPF portfolio going forward. Chairperson, these are some of the investments. This slide has already been shared with this committee by the PIC last week. In terms of being a leader in responsible investing, we're starting to get a lot of feedback. You'll see this was an article in the UK where they referred to South African Fund as the pride of the continent. This is a letter that our board received today from CalPERS, which is known as one of the top pension funds worldwide, recognizing the GPF as a leader in responsible investing. And then we've got a document that was developed by the UNPRI using the GPF as a case study of a leader in responsible investing. We don't often celebrate this, but I think it's a good indicator of how far we are in achieving the first strategic objective of being a leader in responsible investing. Chairperson, our second strategic objective is to be a one-stop financial services that offers members and pensioners improved benefits. In this pillar, Chairperson, we have identified opportunities that exist within the developmental investment policy that has a direct impact on our members, and hence the social pillar that I've just shared with you in our developmental strategy will be one of the key pillars in this initiative going forward. And we are also actively involved, even though we're not driving the process, but we're providing technical expertise in assisting in setting up the government employee housing scheme. We believe that this scheme will require investment capital, and it's important that at any point, whenever government is able to reach conclusion with the parties at the PSCBC, we hope investment opportunities will arise for us to participate in. We are also, Chairperson, on various occasions, Minister of Finance had indicated that his preference would be to see the GPF falling under the FSB ambit and PFA. We're therefore also starting to align some of the benefits of the GPF in line with the Pension Fund Act. As you've seen in recent times that we've introduced the clean break principle, and then we also have a project internally to identify the gaps between the GEP law and the Pension Fund Act. We are also in the process of finalizing our consultation process with stakeholders to see if it's possible for the GPF to implement an additional voluntary contribution scheme. Because if you remember in our opening remarks, we said it was important to educate members about saving for retirement, but we also believe it's important to create vehicles or platforms for members to contribute towards so that they can save adequately for their retirement. We are also in the process of finding ways in which we can use the GPS size to negotiate benefits for our members in the private sector, and we are busy with a test case study, and we're hoping that at some point we'll be in position to introduce benefits that we believe might not have an impact on the actuarial liability of the fund, but the GPS can use its muscle in finding optimal outcomes in relation to how we interact with the industry for our members. The third strategic objective, Chairperson, is to optimize the fund's governance structure. And in this extent, some of the initiatives we've rolled on, we've reviewed the terms of reference of all the committees of the GPF, including the current policies and the governance charters, and have aligned them with best practices in relation to governance. We've also developed a detailed trustee training development and trustee leadership. Our board members or trustees are members of the Institute of Directors, and they continuously seek enhancement in terms of their skills to ensure that they can execute their responsibilities humbly and deliver on their mandate. We are also aligning our corporate governance in line with international best practices. The GPF recently participated on a study on governances among best pension funds in the world, and it's one of those areas that we are proud that we have scored very well, and we continue to humble ourselves and continuously work towards making sure that the GPF is the best institution on the African continent and the world. We're working towards introducing an integrated reporting framework so that we are able to report adequately on all these initiatives that we are embarking on going forward. Chairperson, the fourth strategic objective was to be an employer of choice, and some of the initiatives that the board has embarked on, it has recently appointed an independent REMCO committee, which was established in line with industry best practices and populated by independent experts. We're working towards a performance-driven value-based system. We've also ensured that we run a program of life coaching and mentoring programs for our executives and middle management, given the enormity of the responsibility and the task that has been given to us in relation to managing the GPF. Chairperson, the last strategic objective is that we want to establish and maintain credibility with stakeholders. In this regard, we've conducted an independent brand health audit. We're currently trying to implement the new corporate identity. We want to increase stakeholder engagement going forward, and we are working on repositioning the GPF as a trusted South African brand. In terms of the independent audit outcome, you would see that we appointed Div Economics to do an audit and interact with our stakeholders to tell us about what is their perception about the GPF brand. And some of the things that they have highlighted, they said that we did not communicate well our split between GPF and JEPA. It's something that came through that process. Another issue, they said that service delivery issues are important, and they said that inadequate database, we need to improve our IT systems. We need to, contact issues, the skill shortage. The other issue that was highlighted in this independent audit was communication issues. Our members said we're not communicating enough. They wanted us to communicate more. And then the other issue that came out of this independent exercise was that there was no clear brand and there was a lack of deliberate brand strategy. So this is something that organizations that strive to improve themselves are happy to go through an exercise as painful as this one, get the facts, and then be able to respond. And that's what we are doing as the GPF in relation to our brand. So in response to this, we have said that, look, JEPA, which is the Government Pension Administration Agency, born out of the GPF, is mainly the face of the GPF, and our members experience our brand through JEPA. So obviously we believe that JEPA going forward has to play a more active role in ensuring that it looks after the GPF brand and communicate through to our stakeholders. And we are actively managing JEPA through our SLA, and then we're providing capital that is required to ensure the modernization, ensure that there's adequate IT systems, as was highlighted by the research going forward. And as the chairperson highlighted in his opening remarks, we're starting to see positive trends in JEPA. I mean, we've discussed the auto-verification, live verification process, which we believe that some of those processes we'll start seeing the results 2-3 years from now. So So we continuously supporting Mr. G and his team in ensuring that we are able to assist JEPA to turn around going forward. In terms of some of the strategic initiatives of JEPA, we can see that they are already linked to our mission of ensuring timely and efficient delivery of pensions and benefits to our members. They are busy trying to automate service delivery, improve people competence, innovate, maintain systems, improve performance against the service level agreement that they have with the GEPF, and then obviously stakeholder management, Chairperson. But obviously we're not here to speak on behalf of JEPA, and I don't think I'm qualified enough to speak on behalf of JEPA, but we just thought that it was important that we just highlight that to the committee. We understand that JEPA at some point will come and present to the committee on their strategy, and we'll encourage that the committee can have detailed engagement with JEPA at that stage. In terms of our brand, as you indicated, one of the findings of that audit exercise was that there was no clear brand strategy. We've been working towards developing that strategy and ensuring that it's based on our mission. And you can see that we're going to base it on four pillars. We're going to have an active brand management, make sure that member communication is focused. It's educating our members about their benefits, manage issues, and obviously stakeholder relations. And then obviously at the back of that, we need to have a clear, distinct brand. You'll see that in most of the documents that we have from the GPF, you often don't have a clear, distinct brand. Sometimes you see coat of arms, sometimes you see something else. So obviously we've went through an exercise of finding a brand that we can associate with and a corporate identity that we can associate with. This is almost resembles the sign of a tree, but anchored by people. You can see that people are very important to us and the branch of the tree indicating wealth. We believe as the GPF, it is their investment and it is their wealth. In terms of the allocation of budget, I think, Chairperson, we are very actively monitoring our costs. You will see that the GPF total assets under management are sitting at about 1 trillion. I've just rounded the figure to 1 trillion. And the investment management fees and actuarial fees are the major component of our costs. They are sitting at about 1.1 billion, and about 50% of that money is payable directly to PIC, and then other is payable to other asset managers that we have in the portfolio. However, when you look at the overall cost relative to the assets of the fund, you can see that the costs at the GPF are sitting at about 0.18%, which I think they are very reasonable compared to our industry peers. I thank you.
That's our story, Chief.
Thank you. Mr. Oliphant and the chair,
quite an interesting presentation and very detailed. Honorable members, I mustn't summarize on your behalf. I must allow you to interact with the presentation. Honorable Steve Goranoff, followed by Honorable Luyenge Swart, and Honorable Luyenge, followed by Ma Adams and the Nyambos Mtetwa. Ndadero, and then you'll be the sweeper. Okay, all right. In that order. We will take the first batch of questions in that order. If there's follow-up questions, then we'll take them. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. And may I commend the GEPF for exceptionally good work done that's acknowledged worldwide. And we see it in those letters. And thank you for the good work as a custodian of the pension fund for government. I just ask one or two questions. And I'm looking at your annual report. I don't know if you've got that annual report in front of you. And in particular, on page 98, and it's a general question on your notes to the annual financial statements, which relates to the investment in bonds, the financial instruments. Not a particular one, but it's a principal question that I've got that's been speculated a lot in the media, and that is the impact of your, and I appreciate it's also probably through the PIC, but the impact of the investment with SANRAL. And I'd like you to give us an indication of what impact the delay in the implementation of e-tolling will have on your investments. Secondly, I'd ask you about page 31. There is an indication about backlogs for the benefit payments at that stage. Page 31 in the column on the right-hand side. The agency that your Government Pensions Administration agency reduced the backlogs of benefit payments by 66%, which is really good, from 14,000 to 4,741. A total of 3,000 of the remaining cases are with employer departments. Now, the concern that I've got is the delay that it takes from the point the person, the pensioner, resigns to the point that he gets starts getting his payment. And I'm sure you've had these complaints raised continually. And I appreciate it's often not your fault or the administration agency's fault, but the fault lies with the employer departments to provide validation and additional information. How can we as parliamentarians assist you to ensure that civil servants that retire or resign are speedily paid? And that is just my initial questions, thank you, Chair, but I just want to emphasize my commendations for the good work that you've done. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me first appreciate this elaborate presentation and, of course, a detailed one, as the Chairperson has said. But the question that I have, Chair, is with regard to the measurability of the objectives. The initiatives that are there, they are good, they are all progressive. But my main worry now is the question of quantifying them with timelines. Like with regard to the social responsibility or housing that you have reflected on that you want to intervene. Do you have any timeline that you would want to see that happening? And if that is the case, is there any kind of relationship that you have with other bodies that actually do the same, like your municipalities in the housing sector, as well as the Department of Human Health Settlement? And what form of or what mode are you going to use? Are you going to maybe engage service providers of such a deliverable, or are you going to maybe have funding that you will transfer, assist the department or a particular municipality? Then the other one, Chair, is with regard to the retirement annuities. Bodies that are actually working with these products of retirement, like in the insurance industry. Are you actually working hand in glove with them in terms of ensuring that civil servants who are actually contributing as well in those industries and also they are your clients are actually benefiting profusely around issues of the annuities as well as your payouts from this side. Yeah, I think those are the questions, Chair. If I may actually ask for a HR strategy that seeks to ensure retention of your staff and maybe an indication around the vacancy rate in the institution. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I want to congratulate the GPS on the enthusiasm that they displayed this morning. I think we as pensioners' funds are in good hands. Mine is on slide 18, Chairperson, and that is on strategic objective number 2. I think I was partly covered by the Honorable Luenge. One of the objective initiatives is to set up assist in setting up a government employee housing scheme in line with the DI policy. I just like to know the time frames. As you said, pensioners are rich collectively, the members of the GPF, but individually, not so. And then in the development of your logo, did you involve your members? Just for interest's sake. And then your main findings in the summary, you'd like to enhance your shortage skills. How would you do that? And how do you intend to better your communication with your members? That's all on slide 22. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is on slide 25. The monitoring of that membership communication. How do you ensure that this plan through your agency, it gets down to the members that contribute to the fund? I'm also covered in terms of their housing. And also, most of these people, these government employees, do you have a plan? How do you are going to assist them, particularly in giving bursaries to their kids? Others, they get problems along the way and get dismissed or injured. How do you take care of the family thereafter, other than the looking at this baby tree with the big head and utilize that money effectively so that it assists the people that have already contributed to it? What is your strategy in trying to ensure that those people do get bursaries, they are assisted in one way or other? Your logo as well, it looks a good logo, but to me it's a baby with a kwashiorkor. It's got this big headed. Are these people smelling what is on top of them, or are they going to get it? Looking at it, if you interpret it, to me, it's more like they are smelling what is on top, wishing to touch it one day. That will never, ever come. Let's not enjoy it, the trillions of rand. Let's make it sure that it's big on the ground and thinner on the top. That's it.
Thank you, Chair. The presenter mentioned the underinvestment in infrastructure and the subsequent problems with not adequate supply of electricity and the implications it had on the equity portfolio. My question would be, is it possible that we can have an indication as to the percentage loss that you had on your equity portfolio because of the non-supply of electricity and because of smelters not being operative? And perhaps comparing it to the current situation where what we have today, where we also have a shortfall of supply, which is about 3,000 megawatts currently, and where we have voluntary closing of smelters once again. And I would like to know if you can give us any indication what the issue would be or what the percentage perhaps might be in terms of your recovery of your equity portfolio and the current situation also again with perhaps problems in terms of inadequate supply. Thank you, Chair. And the second one, just a second, right to the Chair, quickly, the annual reports, also page 99. It's the loan investment that has included the loan to Black Ginger, and there was an indication that the loan had no fixed repayment terms. Just in terms of your standard practice, in terms of fixed repayment terms and soft loans, is there any indication that you can give us more information regarding that? Thank you.
Ralph Van Royen. Thank you very much. I'm not sure if we are still going to accord the administration agency the opportunity to present or can we just pose questions that are related to some of the observations on the administration agent? But if you allow me, Chair, I just wanted to check, or maybe I must first make a confession. You know, this, as much as I might sound a bit contradictory to my colleagues on the issue of details, it was very difficult for me to do my homework in terms of preparing for this sitting without the detailed strat plan. Because here we are having slides, and there is no detailed strat plan. I don't know what's the reason for that. I tried my level best to retrieve or to get one, but unfortunately, I was told that it's not possible. And as a result, I feel like some areas, I mean, I don't have details on some of the areas. I appreciate the fact that the this morning we were given the annual report, but unfortunately, that's not the purpose of our engagement today. And maybe we need to come out clear on the, how do we time the release of your annual report as well as the presentation of your strategic plan for the upcoming financial year. Because in my take, these are two different processes, but very complementary. You know, so I'm I was a bit disorganized, I mean, to say the least, I mean, in terms of preparing for this meeting. Like, I picked up an article, and fortunately the presentation they did cite on the issue of the increase that was effected. I picked up an article in the newspaper indicating that I think there was an apology from your side on the communication challenge that emerged out of this whole process, where the increase was effected without involving members. I'm not sure if as to what are the reasons, or maybe what are the remedial steps that have been taken to make sure that we don't have such a recurrence. But also, my specific question was, I really want to check what is costing us, I mean, to sustain this agency, the administration agency. I mean, the cost of outsourcing it, but also its efficiency. Are we really realizing? I know there was an indication that there are areas that will need further improvement, but I just wanted to check if really the cost that we are incurring as a result of this agency will, in the long run, add value, the much-needed value, into the broader institution, or maybe into the fund. And Chair, on strategic objective number 3, where you speak of optimizing your governance structure, I am definitely sure that if one had a comprehensive a plan, one would be understanding what is the current status quo around your compliance issues on corporate governance. Because one of the key things that you are targeting here is to ensure that there is, I mean, compliance to issues of international practice as far as corporate governance is concerned. My specific question is, what is the current status quo? Where are the gaps? I mean, that you think, I mean, you'll be able to address, I mean, as cited in the said strategic objective number 3. Thank you, Chair.
You, Chair, and your team.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to apportion the various questions to the team that I've brought here. On Sandron, the impact of the investment, the delay, I would ask Mr. Oliphant to deal with that. Issues related to the exit of members from the GEPF and the processes. I would humbly request that the team from GPA, that's Mr. G and Mrs. Scola, to handle that one. Because it's a matter that we have raised when we processed our other annual report about the need for an interface between the different systems. the Honorable Yenge on the issues of social responsibility and housing, the timelines. Mr. Olifant can deal with the PSBC processes, including the issues of retirement annuity. On our HR strategy and retention and vacancy rate in GPF, I'll give it to Ms. Jolene Moodley. On the logo, there's an issue of the involvement of members. Yes, Ms. Olifant will deal with that and better communication with our members. I'll come to Mr. Honorable Yenge. Also, it's a matter of member communication. I would ask Mr. Olifant to deal with that, together with issues of batteries to our members, issues of the edu loan. There's a criticism about our logo. We take that into consideration from Ms. Honorable Lienge on under investment in infrastructure. I'll just give you a brief comment, but ask Mr. Olifant to deal with the issues of under investment in infrastructure. And deal also with the payment terms to Black Ginger, which was page 99 of our annual report. The issues of that was raised by Honorable Des Van Rooyen on the strategic plan annual report, I'll deal with that. And the costs of that we have incurred in relation to GPA, I'll hand over to the deputy chairperson of the board, Mr. Badad. Compliance governance, I'll ask Ms. Adrie van Niekerk to deal with the compliance, governance, and identification of possible gaps. Okay, Ms. Olfer.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll start with the issue of the housing matter in terms of timelines. We appreciate the fact that housing is a big challenge. We also appreciate the fact that it's also a great investment opportunity. However, there are various bodies that are involved, and that's why in terms of the timelines, we can't commit to anything because that is driven by the Public Sector Coordinated Council. We're just participating in giving them the technical input. However, we haven't folded our arms. If you go to our presentation, you will notice that there are elements where we're already participating in housing projects. However, we're trying to work hard to ensure that we are able to have one that is directly impacting our members. So we're hoping and working very hard in ensuring that we are able to get all the parties to agree on the outcomes of that process. And then on the educational loans, it's one of our pillars in terms of pillar two. What we've noticed is that actually most of the institutions that provide educational loans, they provide them at a higher interest rates, and our members end up suffering. And when we look at this institution, they raise money from institutions like GPF. So in their effect, members are actually borrowing their money at a very exuberant interest. So it's one element that we are zooming in. We must admit that at this stage, we don't necessarily have the expertise to administer such a product. And to some extent, we have to rely on the pioneers in the industry that have been doing it. And I think our Public Investment Corporation has been engaging with various entities, and then we're waiting for a proposal on their part. We've set the policy, we've set the strategy, and then we've also understand the urgency around the matter. And we're hoping that with the new model for unlisted investments, which we shared with you at high level, we're hoping that all these gaps around implementation would be addressed, because the problem with having good policies is often to match it with their correct skills to implement. And I think we've acknowledged that. We've received that criticism also from Parliament when members of Parliament visited our offices. And then we took it in, and that's why we developed a new model for unlisted investments. And we're hoping under this new model, there'll be a greater turnaround on decision-making on investment opportunities, greater alignment of interest, and then also better risk management. Because in an unlisted investment, you can get exposed to greater risk, but the rewards also can be high. So we need to balance the two and ensure that we are able to account. So therefore, I think the tree that you see is an indication that the GPF exists as a result of the members, because the members are the stem. And that is the flag, and I believe that
those opportunities, they need to start enjoying them. And that's why we're working very hard in achieving that. on how we plan to enhance on communication to our members, we know that there's a weakness in relation to not only in the GEPF, but in the industry. You know, a lack of educating people around their retirement savings. I mean, I'm also a victim of it, where people see pension savings and immediately resign so they can have access to that money and forget about the consequences at retirement. It's a challenge not only for the GPF, but it's a challenge for the whole pension fund industry. And we are saying we need to work harder to find ways that we can educate our members better so that we are able to ensure that they've got sufficient savings going forward into their retirement savings. There was also another question related to the impact of the electricity shortage that came from Honorable Ross. It's very difficult to actually pin it down because remember in 2007, or just pre-2007, we had the electricity crisis. Most of our equity exposure in the resource sector, we've got a big holding in BHP Billiton. I think we own about 7% of BHP Billiton. We've got a big shareholding in Anglo and so forth. And you would know that you know, the share price of these entities, given that they are listed on the JSE, they always react to news. But we were quite happy that, you know, some of the unintended consequences of the economy crisis was to slow down the economy, and that's why we could, you know, restart the process and we're able to, you know, to get good investment returns. You will know that the GPS asset had dropped to about 628 a billion, but today we're sitting at 1 trillion, you know. But let me just deal, because on the issue of the terms of the loan, as you know that we set the policy. So what happened is that PIC make all these investments on our behalf, and we only monitor them. So we often don't get involved in negotiating the terms of the loan and so forth. But now with the new model for unlisted investments, we set a new governance structure, and obviously the GPF will be in a better position to monitor it. So historically, all the decisions that have been reflected on our annual report were the decisions that were made by the PIC, especially in relation to investments. So we're not involved in negotiating terms. What we do set for the PIC is investment return targets. So we will agree with them and say we're expecting a 10% return, and then obviously they will structure whatever deal they will structure such that they are able to achieve that element of return. I think the chairperson wanted to add on the economic.
Yeah, no, just a short one. There was a study that was done about the impact of the shutdowns in the mining industry on the GDP of South Africa. I can try to get that report, but obviously it's quite dated. And I think Mr. Olifant is correct. We would not be able to quantify that type of impact on our investment. But there is a study that shows the impact of the South Africa.
Chairperson, the other question related to how do we monitor communication and ensure that communication, our strategy gets communicated well to our members. What we've done is that we've resourced our team at the GPF level. We've brought in communication skills, and in that process we've established an editorial committee which has members both from JEPA and the GPF who drive content in relation to what's communicated to members. But we think the challenge that lie ahead in terms of communication is enormous, and we therefore believe that over the next 3 to 5 years you'll start seeing, you know, significant changes, because it's embedded in our strategy going forward in relation to ensuring that we communicate adequately to our members. Education obviously will be the key driver, because we need to educate not only, you know, our members, but the whole industry also requires a bigger challenge in terms of educating the members. The cost of administration, that was another question to say, when would we start seeing the results? We're spending about 670 million on administration, And I think if you take it to a level of, we participated recently in the ASISA study, which looked at cost of administering pensions. And I think the GPF in that study came favorably, because usually in pension funds, they look at the cost per member. If you say this 670 or so million, if you were to divide it per member, how much is it costing you to administer effectively? And we believe that that process will lead us to be more efficient. Obviously, also the GPF, through the administration agreement, also committed itself in assisting JAPAR to turn around. We've also committed into a five-year transitional period, which inside involves the modernization of JAPAR. And we're starting to see the benefits. I mean, you can only imagine if you're a pensioner of the GPF somewhere in the rural areas in the Eastern Cape, a police station 20 kilometers away, having to, find transport, go to a police station, get your form stamped by the police officer to confirm that you are still alive. That was a taxing process on our pensioners. And today we are able to use technology where we can interface with the Department of Home Affairs and be able to tell whether our main pensioner is still alive or not. So some of those benefits are starting to come through, but I think we are remaining committed in assisting Mr. G and the leadership within Japan in ensuring that they are able to deliver on administration in the long term. And in relation to the Japan, I believe that the committee is more than welcome to invite Japan to come and present a more detailed strategy around their turnaround strategy. Chairperson, I don't know, I've dealt with all the questions that you have allocated to the Sandra one. I'm not trying to avoid it.
It's not a hot one.
Look, the question we had was that what is the impact of the delay on e-tolling on the portfolio? I just want to put this into context. The GPF has 1 trillion assets under management. It has to diversify its portfolio, so it will participate in a various investment opportunities in the economy. So in relation to Sanral, although it's widely reported in the newspaper that GPF is invested in the Gauteng e-toll, that is an incorrect reporting, because now that reflects as if e-tolling has a specific vehicle that was used to fund it. We bought Sanral bonds, and obviously Sanral bonds, you buy it at the company level, and then obviously they will choose what they do with the money. They had opted to build a new highway. Now, the credit rating of Sanral, it's triple A, I think, and I mean, obviously, recently the credit rating agencies have put a negative watch on Sanral because they were worried about the development. Just to give you an idea, Transnet also traded at triple A as well, and other many SOEs, and the yield on the government bond when we came into Sanral was above 9%, and it's still trading around that level. So obviously, the delay in e-tolling might have an impact on the ability of Sanral in servicing the debt. But so far as the GPF, we haven't been given any signals relating to the contrary. So we still continue to hold our bonds like any other institution. I've been told that many South African institutions, especially asset managers in South Africa, they also have an exposure towards Sanral in relation to the bonds.
Can I hand over to Jolene and then Arthur?
Chair and committee, I think the question related to the GPF HR strategy and our current vacancy and employee capacity complements that. In terms of the HR strategy, the GPF in 2010, following the separation, identified the strategic objectives that the acting principal officer just alluded to. So one of the strategic objectives is being an employer of choice. And as a committee, you will understand that that is a journey. And in terms of our strategy, that's how we're viewing our HR strategy as a journey. In terms of, firstly, obviously, post the separation, establishing the correct basic people management processes. Secondly, looking at the long-term view of human capital requirements and embedding the practices and processes in the organization going forward. And some of the initiatives that has been highlighted in our strategy for this year relates to reviewing those processes and then obviously building on that. And I think a key component of that is in capacitating our current leadership and middle management. The skills audit will help us establish our skills gap and also correctly identify our training and development objectives. So we see ourselves working in terms of this HR journey in three phases. The foundation and stability phase, looking at our basics and are they correct, then going on to the ensuring performance management and value-based culture within the organization. You would understand that performance management brings about excellence in the organization, and that's one of the priorities that has been identified. The second phase would look at the long-term reviews, our HR processes, the remuneration strategy, and I believe that the establishment of the independent REMCO is going to help us going forward in terms of that. So our current staff complement, the board has recently approved 5 additional staff members, so we are now sitting at 27 as staff complement. We have a vacancy rate of 6 at the moment, and 21 are filled. The 6 is the new 5 positions that have been appointed by the board and the people. So that's basically in a nutshell how we...
Thank you, Chair. I will deal with the question as to why the GPS strategic plan is not submitted to this committee, as well as the gaps in the corporate governance within the fund. The GEP law, as stated by our acting principal officer, basically prescribes the reporting requirements of the fund, and it prescribes that the board must submit its annual financial statement together with a report on the affairs of the fund to the Minister of Finance, and then the Minister of Finance will submit the annual report to Parliament together with any comments. So currently they don't have any legislative requirements in tabling the strategic plan to Parliament like other government departments and state-owned enterprises. The GPF itself, or the cost for running the fund is paid by the fund. We don't get any funds from Treasury. It's not to say that we don't have a detailed strategic plan. The board developed strategic objectives in 2010, and annually the Office of the Principal develops a detailed business plan with a budget with very clear deliverables that will ensure that the board will reach its strategic objectives to the board for its approval. And then the board approves the budget and business plan of the GPF as the executive authority of the fund. Then just to address the question regarding the gaps in corporate governance currently in the fund, as the acting principal officer noted, we recently participated in an international corporate governance survey where all the big defined benefit funds internationally participated. It was a qualitative and a quantitative survey. The GPF did very well. 2 small gaps were identified during the survey, which the GPF is busy addressing. We've also now conducted a detailed compliance audit with regards to compliance of our governance practices with King 3 and PF 130. It's important to note, because we don't fall under the Pension Fund Act currently, we don't have to comply with PF 130. However, for good governance practices, we do try to comply. We've recently completed the survey or the audit. We've now developed action plans to address any areas of non-compliance or partial compliance, and we are going to shortly now implement the action plan. With regards to King 3 compliance, I think the big issue there that we don't fully comply currently with is Section 9 of King, where they deal with integrated reporting. However, as we all know, the Integrated Reporting Committee of South Africa has only recently now finalized or are busy finalizing the guidelines. So we are planning to shortly then move to full integrated reporting within the fund.
I'm going to ask the GFA team to deal with the 2 outstanding questions.
and they should bear in mind that they're still going to come.
Yes.
So they must just be brief, straight to the point.
Yeah, we are going to come. Just to say, the backlogs issue, currently at the end of March, we are standing at around 2,261. So it's a reduction from 4,761 to 2,261. In terms of our working relationship with departments, let me just indicate that the working relationship has increased vastly, but what we're going to do in the coming year is to enter into a formal agreement, just like what the private sector pension funds do, enter into a formal agreement with the employers to give us information timeously, so that we can exit members timeously when they come on board. But overall, I think our roadshows, our education campaign to members and employers themselves have contributed significantly to the reduction of the backlogs. Just to indicate that when the first board started in 2005-06, the backlog stood at 24,000. Now, 7 years down the line, they are now standing at 2,261 as at the end of the March. We will give a detailed presentation to this committee in 2 weeks' time, so the committee will be able to engage with us.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's important for us to also emphasize on the issue of the submission of the annual report, that indeed we submitted the annual report to Parliament last year. But there's a fundamental distinction that we need to make here between the GPF as compared to other public entities. The GPF is a public interest institution, which is not listed under the PFMA. So the governance arrangement around public entities does not apply to the GPF. Indeed, we do have a specific plan as indicated by Ms. Van Niekerk, and we thought this would be a session where we could engage on the high-level stuff around the strategic plan. But the distinction is around it being a public interest institution and not being a public entity, and therefore it's not regulated by the PFMA. It's only regulated by the GP law. And it's only under Section 9 and 10 where we are required to submit the annual report to Parliament through the Minister of Finance. But it's an arrangement that we can look into if there are challenges.
I think we should note that point.
We're involved, so I think I can maybe give Kai an opportunity to respond to Honorable Adams.
Kai, I'm telling you, I'm sorry, I think I didn't introduce him. He's a key man.
I thought he was your bodyguard.
Kai, I'm telling you, he's our communication officer.
Yeah. No, thank you, Chair. Just in response to whether the members and pensioners were involved or not, last year we appointed a research company to assist us with conducting brand research. So it was a plus minus 4 months kind of exercise where we interacted with members and pensioners as to what kind of brand they would like to see going forward. So the findings of that brand research then informed the kind of logo that you developed. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Kaya. Honorable members, I don't know if we would still want to make some follow-up questions given the fact that we don't have much time. Let me also take this opportunity to welcome Tim, Honorable Tim Harris. I did receive your apology. Thank you very much for being so professional. You are not here, but I know you have read the presentations. And therefore, it will be uncharacteristic so to not for you to pose a question. I see you have got some edge to say something.
Thanks, Chair. And again, I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the meeting. Please, I'm not sure what has been asked, so just inform me if a question has been asked. But On the SANRAL issue, I understand the pension fund owns 50% of SANRAL's bonds. Who owns the rest? Then my second question is, I understand that 50% of the bonds that you own are guaranteed by the state. What about the rest, the other half of your 50%? And surely, if you've bought bonds in an institution that's no longer able to generate the revenue to pay off its debts, then you are quite seriously exposed, and the government pensioners are quite seriously exposed without the protection of that guarantee. When did you buy the SANRAL bonds? And when you did you know about the business model of SANRAL for the tolling in particular? Were you aware that there was this e-tolling project coming down the line and that would be a material income source for the bonds that you were buying? Or did you buy without knowledge of that model? I think the pension fund has north of 100 billion invested in projects run by the state and enterprises. But earlier this year, we heard the finance minister say that the SOEs failed to spend about 40% of the money they were given to build infrastructure in 2010. I mean, surely this raises a serious question mark over your investments effectively in those SOEs if they are failing to spend 40% of their infrastructure budgets. And then how I'm concerned about the discussion around prescribed assets and what the funds, where the funds' allegiance would lie, because you have government, if government decided to be more let's say aggressive in prescribing the assets you need to hold, you may have a contradiction with the interests of your members and pensioners. Surely there's a conflict of interest there from your side, where on the one hand you're meant to be holding your pensioners' interests foremost, yet you have government as a clear stakeholder that might prescribe policy that is not in their best interest. Whose side of the fence do you then fall on as the fund? And then I asked the PIC what the actuarial surplus is of the fund, and they told me to ask you, because I understand that, so I'd like to know what that number is. And I understand that this is one of the few funds that's retained its defined benefits status. Most other funds have switched to defined contribution. Now, I'm assuming that actuarial surplus is quite big. Couldn't you offer that as an incentive to convert to the pensioners to convert to defined contribution, which would remove the taxpayer backstop, but I think provide align the incentives of the fund with the investments that you make. So like most other pensioners in this country, almost all of the others, you would have a defined contribution, which I would argue would probably be better for you as investors in the investors of the pension fund, plus better for the economy at large, because it would make you more activist investors. Another option is perhaps I'm not sure if the medical aid of the public sector pensioners is funded. Perhaps you could use the actuarial surplus to cover that medical aid. Is that another option? I mean, I have a set of questions around the actuarial surplus and also whether it's included in the government's balance sheet. I mean, surely it's an asset that we could use to strengthen the government's balance sheet as a whole. Is that an option? And if it isn't included in the balance sheet, why not?
So I was right, Tim, that it would be unlike you not to have questions. But it's fine. Honorable Mloto and your team, let's try to be...
I'll be very short, and I'll ask Mr. Oliphant to assist in us answering some of the questions. You said that 50% of the bonds are guaranteed. What about the rest? In the statement of Mr. Oliphant, he did indicate that SANRAL is a AAA rated agency, and our view is that the credit rating of Sandal, when you take investment decision, should guide you in coming to that investment decision. But I think the more fundamental question that you're asking is about the exposure on the other 50%. My understanding, and I'm subject to correction, is that Sandal is an entity that has been established by legislation which was passed through this institution. And therefore, if a decision has to be taken on the liquidation of Sandal, then the institution would have to take a decision on the liabilities of Sandal. We all know that the credit rating of Sandal would also have an impact on the credit rating of South Africa, and National Treasury would obviously would want to take a different view on that matter. On the SOEs and their failure to build, it's a valid point that you have raised, but we need to indicate from our side that we are bondholders and not shareholders. As bondholders, our main concern is the ability of these entities to service the debt. And if we are shareholders, we would be asking different types of questions on the governance arrangement and the performance of SOEs. Lastly, Chairperson, just a quick one on the prescribed assets. I think you missed part of our presentation. We have got a developmental investment policy, and that developmental investment policy was crafted prior to me being a chairperson of the board, which could be around 2008-2009. It was informed by different considerations, and we believe we are involved in the developmental space, as indicated by Mr. Oliphant, and therefore there will be any conflict of interest on our side, because it was a conscious decision that we took as a board to get involved in developmental investing without being prompted by anybody. Mr. Oliphant, you deal with the issue of the other issues on Sandal and the defined benefit and the surplus. And lastly, I mean, this is my own individual opinion. I'm not sure what the employees of government would say on this one. If I was an employee of government, I would not want to move to a DC, to a defined contribution, because I'll be carrying the investment risks. A defined benefit would be more of an advantage to me as an employee of government, because the investment risks are carried by the employer.
I think, thank you, Chairperson. I think the other question on Sandal said the GPF is holding half and who holds the other half. I've brought to my attention that most of the asset managers in South Africa hold Sandal bonds. I mean, Sandal bonds are listed, so everyone trade on them, but I mean, to the best of my knowledge, most of the asset managers have an exposure to Sandal, mainly because of their good credit rating and so forth. Obviously, that might be impacted by the decisions around ETOL and so forth. Mainly where I wanted to come in was the issue around the actuarial surplus. I wish we had an actuarial surplus. Earlier on in the presentation, I referred to the liabilities of the fund, and I did indicate that today we talk proudly about the GPF assets being above 1 trillion, but we didn't celebrate the liabilities of the fund being above 1 trillion. The GPF liabilities, what we did, which I mean, given the prudence and all that in our board, we were worried about the impact of the economic crisis that was going on in Europe. As you know, there's a lot of credit issues in that side. So the board did an interim evaluation in September 2011 to try and see what was the financial position of the fund at the time. And when we did the evaluation in September 2011, we had the assets of the GPF at the time were sitting at 927 billion, and the liabilities of the fund, this is the best estimate that actuaries could put on our liabilities, was sitting at 936 billion. So you could see that the liabilities at the time were bigger than the assets. Okay. So now the GPF law prescribes and says that if the assets are at 90% of the liabilities, the GPF board has to take extraordinary steps to restore the funding level of the fund. But we didn't have to do so given that it was only at 99% and our view of the economic environment had that
the issues in the long term will start to settle. So from September 2011 to now, the GPF assets are sitting at about 143 billion or so. Now, if you look at that valuation that was done in September, the actual reset, if the fund was able to grow at 5% between September and March, the funding level of the fund will remain at 99%. And then he said that anything above that will translate into an improvement in the funding ratio of the fund. So given that the fund is up about 12% or so from September to today, we think that when we do our, we are busy with our statutory valuation as of 31 March, which will be submitted to Parliament at a later stage, we think the position of the fund will have returned back to 100%. So we're quite confident around it, but in terms of the issues of surplus, we don't have a surplus at the moment and so forth. But also the law has got prescriptions around what you can do. I mean, it says that in the case where there's a surplus, you have to review the contribution rates. So remember that currently government contributes 16% on behalf of services, and then about 13% for non-services, and then a member contributes 7.5%. So the employer contribution rate is the one that is allowed to fluctuate. So during the bad times, you'll want to increase the contribution by the employer. And during the good times, you'll want to reduce the contribution so that the employer can use the money for other important issues like paying for e-toll. But now, so from an actuarial point of view, sitting here, I'm very confident that despite the current economic environment, you know, the GEPF's prudent liability-driven investment strategy continue to give us good dividends, and we are able to achieve greater returns for the members. I think the issues around prescribed, the chairperson has dealt with it, and then I don't know if there are any other outstanding issues on the SAMRAL, but
the question, sorry, Honourable Harris, I forgot to apportion to Mr. Oliphant. Your question is, when we invested in SAMRAL, were we aware of the business model of SAMRAL? And you can deal with that.
Most of the, I mean, SAMRAL's balance sheet wasn't that stretched. I mean, they started raising money aggressively in the market from 2008. So most of the bonds were issued in 2008, and they traded at about, at the date of issue, the bonds dated at about, I just have the numbers here, they had a coupon rate of they ranged from 9.75 to about 12.5%. So in 2008, when you looked at an asset and it's going to generate a yield of 12%, any investment person would have participated, and that's why most of the institutions are exposed. So now you would know that, you know, government bonds or institutions that have a AAA rating, they tend to have a better chance of repaying. But, I mean, obviously the business model, somehow it was linked to their ability to collect tolls and so forth. But one has to also think about, you know, what would be the consequences in the future of our country if we fail to finance our infrastructure rollout. And when you look at it from that perspective, you would then have a bit of comfort. And I think even if you look at the debates, I mean, we watched the case very closely, you'd see that the debate is not around not wanting to pay. The debate is around what form should be used to pay. You.
The reason why I want to, sorry, acting principal officer, the issue of SAMRAL, you are but one element, one of the few contributors into, or not contributors or bond holders within SAMRAL. If there are issues around SAMRAL, honorable members, because, in fact, I know it is very topical today. Everybody is speaking about the e-tolling. Not to say it does not have an effect. We've passed the budget here in terms of the government intervention. I think it was the 5.7 or 5.9 billion rand to ameliorate the impact of e-tolling and to ordinary consumers. If there is a strong feeling that we need more information about the impact, this committee is within its own right to invite SANRAL, but I would say even before that, perhaps we should interact with the Minister of Finance to understand the impact of all these issues. You are not here to represent SANRAL, so I don't want you to speak on behalf of SANRAL on these issues. So I'm just saying, honorable members, there is a process that we can follow. Sitting here, we've got, we should not underestimate the ability that the laws of this house allows us to can actually dig information if we want to have more information around that particular matter. So I thought we should not just spend a lot of time on the SANRAL issues here. I see Honorable Swart.
Yes, no, thank you, and I appreciate your concerns, but clearly the impact on the GEP, the GEPF's exposure is, of course, crucial for them to, and they have to a large degree explained that.
Yeah.
But I think it was, it is an issue that they needed to explain to us.
Good.
So, thank you.
Yeah. I'm just emphasizing that they should not over-elaborate as if they are SANRAL themselves. Okay. I think you are almost towards the end. I'm trying to manage time, honorable members. I know we do want to have as much time as possible to interact with these presentations. But bear in mind that we've got FSB that is also here to respond to our request. Honorable Tim Harris, I'm not going to allow you to ask more questions because when we started, we're not here, and unfortunately, we cannot start the meeting from the beginning.
No, Chair, it's just one question that I did ask. I didn't get the specific answer, and that was simply when you purchased the bonds, you said, I think it was around 2008. Obviously, I mean, it's SANRAL. Their income is linked to tolling, but were you aware of the e-tolling project in particular?
Chairperson, I think thanks for your interjection. And you know that credit rating agencies are independent institutions that play a very important role in relation to rating institutions. So SANRAL was rated by many rating agencies as a AAA, and most of the investment decisions will anchor it around that credit rating. And hence, we have made the decision to invest. PIC made the decision to invest on our behalf, and so are the many institutions in South Africa that made their decision on that.
I think you can see that, as usual, those who arrive on time for their meetings, they don't wait for others, especially if they are led by the Deputy Minister. FSB is here. Fortunately, I think we're almost towards the end of our engagement. But I still want to say it is always better, and I hope honorable members, next time we do site visits, will actually really budget that into their programs. Because when you spend a day with an institution, you are able to interrogate all sorts of issues, including their annual plans, their strategic plans, but also to assess even the quality of leadership that is in the institution when you interact with almost everybody. We have said it in the past that we never have enough time here, you know, 1.5 hours to interact with an institution that is actually managing over 1 trillion rands on behalf of 1.2 million public servants. You can never do justice to that. I must thank you, Chairperson, and Deputy Chair. I would report to the CEC that you were present. You are very, very much alive to the issues of the public service pensioners. But there are two issues on my side. I do take the fact that you are saying you are beginning to align your activities with the expectations of the FSB. The one thing that we want to be very, very consistent on is on the issue of King III report, particularly around your board presentations, that we should not find ourselves wanting in that score. And equally, you know, I always say if you've got a bad debtor, the lender may also be equally liable to a certain extent, because you don't lend somebody money without scrutinizing his or her plans if you're a financial institution. Now, you are the government employee pension fund. 90% of that, if not 95% of what you have, is managed by the PIC. You should be equally interested in the governance practice of that institution. It cannot be that you say we don't know what is happening in there. Before you give anybody the right to manage the funds of the workers, you should also be satisfied that the governance model of that institution is in place and it talks to the right issues. The issue of unlisted portfolio, we still want to say, and we did say this to the PIC, that since 1994, I think we have generated enough policies in this country. The issue is implementation. The issue is implementation. We have agreed or made a suggestion to the PIC that we probably want to have a sense of the impact of the social aspects in particular. So we're quite satisfied to a certain extent that you don't sense a risk of the investment in terms of the returns on the fund itself. But we think on the social aspect, it will be important that we begin to see tangible results, because that's how you can begin to relate policies to ordinary citizens of this country. So we hope you also be very much keen to be part of what the committee will be actually making a follow-up on, in terms of just making sure that we fill the direction in which your policies and the strategies that we have actually handed over or shared with the PIC, that this is what you expect from them. So the implementation part of it will be very, very, very much interested in monitoring and evaluating from our side, but you'll be a key player in that aspect or in that arena. Well, I take it it was a light comment from the acting principal officer that waterfront in some time to come it will be under the water. Otherwise, you must exit that investment. You should do so if your predictions are right. We'll be in serious trouble. But I don't think it's something that we need to put on record. I think on behalf of the committee, we would want to thank you very much, Chairperson, and your team. We have also taken note of the fact that as a public interest institution, you are not necessarily governed by the PFMA like public entities, such as those that we've referred to in the past. But I think it will be important that we are not going just to deal with the annual reports. Even the high-level presentation of your strategic plans, this committee should actually have a way of interfacing with almost a detailed plan at some point, not later on. But that's something that we'll have to interact with the executive authority on, understanding the limitations.
Honorable members, I think outside central issues, we are all happy. And we have received an adequate response from GEPF on the issues that they've raised. Thank you very much, Chairperson, Mr. Oliphant, and your delegation. And Adeji, we will see you next time with your team. You are released. No hammering, nothing. Thank you very much. Honorable members, let's take a 5 minute leg stretch. We'll see how we manage the next presentation in terms of time. Thank you very much.
In fact, that deal In fact, he even mentioned it. So when he's on the other side, say, we stand up on the fall, we need to go. But we're sitting out there and say, no, we stand up on the fall. But also your cabinet. We will still listen to you now, or we will have to wait for the government. So, is it the
I don't envy you.
All the best.
Members, can we take our seats? Call them, team. Can't afford to delay. We are 15 minutes out of time. And people plan according to the program before them. So we don't want others to miss their flights and other meetings elsewhere. Deputy Minister, honorable members, and your team, Deputy Minister, we welcome you. On the FSD corporate plan presentation. Mr. Anderson, how are you?
Thank you, Chair.
Good. We We hope you also celebrated May the 1st, Workers' Day, unless you don't consider yourself to be workers anymore. You know, I was just thinking about it. In other countries, this day, or May Day, is really celebrated and led by heads of state, like in our country. And it's not just a day where people sit at home and watch TV. They take their children to be part of the celebration, because it's indeed a very, very important day for the workers, but for every nation. So I hope we did go to the stadiums. I hope we did participate in the activities to celebrate this very, very important day, because the economy of the world is in the hands of these people. Whatever we have, represent the toiling aspirations of our people. But you were there, Nyambos. Okay. Yeah. We must not be confused and say we're not workers anymore. Probably we're all workers at some point. And we're still workers, because I wake up at 3 o'clock to be in a place, like my father used to do. He was a railway worker, laborer, and he used to catch the first train, leaving home at about 4:30 in the morning. I still do the same. So the only difference is that I don't go into a train, I go into a plane. Different. Okay, Deputy Minister and your team, I did say last week that I don't envy you. I don't wish to be in your boots or in your shoes, because this is a very, very demanding task to handhold all the institutions that report to National Treasury, to be part and parcel of the presentation, and to make sure that indeed you are aware of what is happening in those institutions. But thank you very much for being so consistent. I think we should appreciate that as a committee. Over to you, Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. Indeed, it is an unenviable position. This morning I first had to start at the Select Committee on Finance before coming through here. And thanks for allowing time for us to be able to start there, because otherwise I would have found it difficult to split my But Chair, without wasting time, I'm going to be very brief to allow the Chief Executive to present to you the strategic plan of the Financial Services Board, and we know that the Financial Services Board's vision is to promote and maintain a sound financial investment environment in the country. It's enjoined by legislation to ensure that all regulated non-banking financial services entities comply with legislation, and that their capital adequacy requirements are in place, and that they are financially sound, with the whole intention of protecting both the industry and the investing community. It regulates and supervises a range of these institutions: pension funds, friendly societies, long-term and short-term insurance, capital markets, collective investment schemes, and financial advisors and intermediary services. It does this in terms of a whole string of, I'm told, 12 pieces of legislation. And as a statutory body, the policies of the FSB are derived directly from this legislative mandate. Chair, I also take this opportunity to apologize on behalf of the Chair of the Board, Mr. Sitole, who at short notice was not able to make it, and were therefore not able to get somebody to represent the Board. I profusely apologize, Chairperson. very late we were of the understanding that he is going to make it. The board, as you know, Chair, is responsible primarily for the leadership of the FSB for strategic direction and policy, operational performance, financial matters, risk management and compliance. Additionally to this board, with effect from the 1st of April, as the committee will be aware, it also takes over the accounting authority of the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator and the Office of the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Ombud, the FIAS Ombud. The board focuses on four strategic areas, which are to empower consumers of financial products and services, proactive stakeholder management, sound financial institutions, and the fourth being the improved internal policies and processes and procedures. Despite ongoing litigation relating to a number of these cases that are very topical, the Fidentias, Simon Nash's, Kadak Fund, the Financial Services Board is determined not to be sidetracked from achieving its mandate and service to the financial services sector. Chair, as we present this threat plan, the FSB will be shaped by the outcome of the proposals contained in the Red Book called A Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better, which was announced by the Minister of Finance during the budget speech last year and released by the National Treasury during the same year, which sets out the government's vision for the financial sector in South Africa. The draft policy document outlines reform priorities in our four policy areas of financial stability, second, consumer protection, the third being market conduct, and the last being access to financial services and combating financial crime. These will see the Financial Services Board change to a market conduct regulator and shed its prudential regulatory functions as outlined in our Twin Peaks approach. Chair, without wasting time, I'm going to allow the Chief Executive to walk us through our strength plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, and honorable members of the committee. And I would like to start off by introducing my team. The Minister introduced me. I brought two members of the FSB team with me. On the far right is Mr. Sidat Dawood. He's the Chief Financial Officer. And Jerry Anderson, Chief Operations Officer. Again, without wasting any time, Chair and honorable members, the strategic plan that is before you was put together by the FSB team. And we started off by this, the slide number 2, where we outline our vision, our mission, and the values. Those are the things that keep that hold the FSB family together. And with those mission, vision, and values, over the last 20 years, we have had a good number of employees coming to us, and some of them have been with the institution for the 20 years, and observing and respecting all that is captured in that slide. And in preparing the strategic plan, there were important things that needed to be taken into account. We had to look at the whole economic landscape of the country, and that is captured on page 9 of the actual document. We had to look at the supervisory and regulatory framework as a whole. That is captured on page 12 of the document. The relationship with other local regulators, again on page 12. Relationships with international organizations, page 13, and the performance environment of the institution that we have captured in pages 8 to 9 of the document. As the Minister said earlier, we have identified four main pillars as our strategic objectives, And the four are there also on page 63 of the document, but the two gentlemen over there will take you through them in detail. And with that, I hand over to Jerry Anderson to take us through the four objectives. Jerry.
Thank you, Chair, Minister, Mr. Chidi. The strategic plan that has been provided to the committee, Parliament, covers a span of 5 years. And in workshopping this plan, as was mentioned, the four main pillars were identified. These four main pillars being empowered consumers, proactive stakeholder involvement, sound financial institutions, sound referring not only to financially sound but also being run by fit and proper persons, and improved internal policies, processes and procedures. So the first three are outward looking, and the fourth one, Chair, is the inward structure to be able to perform our duties. And in the workshopping referred to, we were able to identify all our projects as outlined in the strategic plan document into one of these four pillars. I'll deal with the first two. Empowered consumers, Chair, is the first of the pillars. And we have two major initiatives. The one is ongoing in our mandate as per the FSB Act, and that is promoting financial consumer education. And we have been active in this field since 2001, and we have a component within the FSB not dedicated to regulation and supervision but to financial literacy promotion and development. The other one, Chair, is what we've now abbreviated into TCF, is treating customers fairly. Page 65 of the strategic plan. The Treating Customers Fairly Initiative, Chair, committee members, is a 3-year rollout, and it looks at outcomes of products that are developed by product providers from the initial development to the after-sale service. Are they developed with a customer and treating the customer fairly in mind? The FSB published a roadmap called the TCF roadmap in November 2011. This is available on our website, www.fsb.co.za. That roadmap sets out the whole process of what TCF is and what TCF strives to achieve is actually the word I was looking for, Chair. In pursuance of the roadmap, we identified 20 institutions which hold 55 to 60 licenses. In other words, some of these institutions hold multiple licenses, maybe a CIS license and a life insurance, life office license, or short-term insurance license. And we've piloted our TCF with these 20 at random selected institutions. And we've learned from the feedback, and the feedback included a meeting on high level with the boards of these institutions, as to what TCF means and what are they doing to embody this culture of treating customers fairly in their whole product range and the whole supply of the product. As far as financial literacy, consumer education is concerned, Chair, members may still remember, the FSB was the host of, under the auspices of the OECD last year, of the International Regulatory Symposium Conference on Financial Literacy here in Cape Town. It was very successful. The feedback that we got was way beyond what we envisaged, and it also showed us during this conference and listening to our counterparts around the world, including Brazil, India, Turkey, and so on, that we are there at the foreground of providing efficient consumer education, and we do understand in the financial field what are the challenges. The second pillar, Chair, speaks about proactive stakeholder management. Consultation. As the other people would say, location. We have again divided this into two focus areas. First of all, it's consultation and good relations with all stakeholders, whether they be regulated entities or whether they be the National Treasury, the Ministry of Finance, or other government bodies whom we regularly have to deal with. And we are looking at our stakeholder management program. This is on page 66 and 67 of the strategic plan. And continuously improving it. For instance, later on during this presentation, we will illustrate what workshops and conferences we will be doing during this year to achieve stakeholder management and stakeholder engagement with our stakeholders, the different regulated entities. On the other hand, Chair, we're looking at an improved communication strategy, increasing the FSB's reputation and brand, becoming more recognizable, and we hope to finalize the whole communication strategy during 2012. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jerry, and thank you, Chair. Committee members, we move on to the next two pillars, which Mr. Siddharth will take us through. Daud.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of our pillar three, sound financial institutions, it's the reason why the FSB came into existence, is ensuring compliance with the legislation that we administer. More than 80% of our budget and our effort is geared to this pillar.
Sorry, Mr. Siddharth. I think, Mr. Luyang, Honorable Luyang, you must sit between Honorable Harris and Honorable Siswart.
We just consulted on our questions.
No, we need to separate the two of you. You're becoming terrible twins.
Okay. My apologies. Okay. No disrespect.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. As part of the organization ensuring that we achieve our objectives with regard to ensuring the sound financial institutions, we will be focusing on ensuring that the FSB regulatory framework is in line with international standards and keeps abreast with the ever-changing market conditions, both locally and internationally. One of our key focus areas around this is that we have now set up a research unit which will coordinate activities within the organization, both internally and externally, to ensure that we do not miss out on what is happening out there in terms of financial regulation, and we try to predict and become more proactive in addressing legislation so that we can try and preempt and try and avoid some of the pitfalls that passed us and the international institutions by. Here we are well in place in terms of completing the implementation of our risk-based supervisory plan and our risk-based supervisory strategy. We will be focusing a lot of our efforts in rolling out risk-based supervision over the next 5 years. Our continuous investment in our enforcement functions, more in terms of our enforcement committee, to ensure that we compel institutions under our control or under our supervision to maintain compliance with legislation. For this next financial year, out of our budget of $503 million, $489 million will be used to ensure that will be used to ensure that this strategic objective is basically maintained. Our last objective, which is our internal focus, is on the FSB internal policies, procedures, and processes. We intend spending $147 million of our budget to ensure that we maintain a comprehensive policy framework, ensure we comply with all the legislation, both the PFMA and all other legislation that affects us. We intend to ensure that we have an adequately resourced FSB to ensure that we're able to deliver on our plan. Our target in terms of vacancies is to ensure that we have no more than a 5% vacancy rate. We're busy redesigning our IT systems. We've now, in terms of IT maturity, want to move from a stable IT environment to a more proactive IT business model where we are able to support, instead of supporting just us in terms of our business processes, we want to make it more efficient and easier for those we engage with from a regulatory point of view and from a stakeholder point of view to engage with us. And Chair, the last objective or the last focus area under this objective is to implement a knowledge management system, which we've realized that if you have a look at the individual sitting next to me, he's been with the FSB for 21 years, and we don't know how to download his brain. So we've realized now that we need to set up a mechanism where we can extract information that sits in various people's and various knowledge databases in our system so that we can all share it with everyone and it remains in an institution indefinitely. We've tried, but his doctor refuses to allow us. So that's one of the new focus areas that we will be spending time and energy on in this financial year.
Your next focus area is download the brain, the content of Mr. Anderson. Okay, all right.
Thank you, Mr. Sidat. The next two slides will be presented again by Jerry Anderson. The focus on the two slides, the first one, we'll be dealing with the fact that, yes, the FSB is a regulatory body, but at the same time, it has to supervise that indeed entities do comply with what they are required to regulate. And this, in a way, it's a normal day-to-day work that has to be carried on irrespective of all these plans and projects and all that. So Jerry will take us through as to what is going to happen by way of supervision in this within this current strategic plan. Jerry.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, you might remember
Mr. Cedar talking about risk-based supervisory approach under sound financial institutions. Now, this is an approach which was adopted by the FSB in 2005, and probably following that adoption by leading regulators early this century. This approach was primarily developed because the old Bretton Woods institutions approach said if you are a regulator, you have to visit an institution on a regular basis, whether it's a 2-year or 3-year or 4-year, depending on the impact. But, Chair, we've got between 7,000 and 9,000 registered pension funds and between 11,000 and 12,000 registered financial services providers. So with the regulation becoming a volume challenge, the traditional visit approach every 2 or 3 years was inadequate. Members will also be aware that the FSB has 4 core line divisions, namely insurance, pension funds, investment institutions, which consists of collective investment schemes and capital markets, and the FICE division, which is the latest child to join the family of the FSB. The FICE division will be planning to do, or has planned to do, 758 on-site visits in terms of its risk-based supervisory approach. And these on-site visits is to not only, although the slides is with the aim to assess compliance with the legislation, it is also to provide guidance and assistance to regulated entities where and when necessary. Pensions division, 240. Collective investment schemes, 54 on-site visits planned, and insurance division, again, 54. That, just to put in perspective, that 54 of the insurance division will be probably half of the insurers registered in South Africa, so it's a very intense type of supervisory approach. Capital markets, seeing that we currently have only one that is ongoing and it's handled differently. Chair, going to the next slide, we want to identify some of the more important projects that we've lined up for the period 1 April 2012 to 31 March 2013. And we list a number of them there. The first one is CISNA. CISNA is actually the Committee of Insurance, Securities and Non-Banking Authorities. And it's a SADC committee. So SADC, as you may know, has a number of committees, and one of them is for regulatory authorities such as the FSB. In some of our SADC counterpart countries, there are 2 or even 3 regulators for what the FSB does in one. So we all come together, whether you got a country with 1 regulator, 2 regulators, 3 regulators, we all get together at least on a regular 6-monthly basis, hosted by different countries who are willing to host. And I'll speak about the CISNA a bit later, but at those formal meetings, we assist one another. We sign, for instance, memorandums of understanding so that we work together with one another on the regulatory front. We help one another. One of those assistants is training. The first bullet point on the slide refers to familiarization projects. The FSB gets worldwide, a lot from Africa, but even worldwide requests, can we come over from a regulator and see how you guys deal with this problem and this matter? We get a lot from Africa, and if we can accommodate these requests, we do. But in Cessna, we are part of SADC. We feel obligated. So if Namfisa from Namibia wants to send people for 2 weeks to see how we operate, how we regulate, these are the familiarization projects, and all divisions of the FSB will be engaged in this during the current year. The next two refer to our financial literacy matters. We have been engaging through the Honourable Minister of Higher Education to do projects in the FET colleges on financial literacy. In training, learners who come into these colleges, on all of them, all over the country, as to giving them courses on how they should budget, how they should manage their finances, and what they should look out for. The South African Council of Churches Special Project Chair was actually an idea that was born in this committee when we were talking about our annual plan 2 years ago. Talking about financial education, one or more honorable members suggested we must try and reach out through existing structures. And the South African Council of Churches was mentioned by name. Chair, it gives me pleasure to report that we have, after engaging with the SACC for 9 months, we have developed an initiative, a project, and we launched the pilot last week, 24th of April, in Kotsu House. Maybe you might have picked it up on the news last Tuesday night or read it in. It was widely covered by most of the media. And this pilot project is aimed at Gauteng. It's a train the trainer, then the trainees go out to the various church communities, and they will be training the communities themselves. And if this pilot proves to be successful, we will be extending it to all 9 provinces in the country. We have also a special initiative particularly aimed at funeral parlors who sell or engaged in selling funeral policies to train from a regulatory perspective, because it's very difficult on that level, the principals engaged in that have difficulty in understanding what the obligations are in terms of the legislative framework. So we've a special project that goes around through the South African Funeral Parlour Association, SAFPA, helps us get the operators together. We speak to them, we help them, we try and bring them into a regulatory network and assist them where they perceive to be difficulties. Usually, most of these difficulties that are perceived are not difficulties, and we can overcome what is the perception.
Sorry, Gary, I know your slides are very few. You've got very few slides. So it doesn't mean that you have to spend a lot of time on one point.
I've nearly finished here. I've spoken about CISNA, and so I don't have to go there again, but this is the regular meetings, and then naturally the last one falls under the upgrading of our ICT infrastructure, internal to improve our efficiencies and to assist with our regulatory and supervisory work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Chair, and once more, committee members. We're moving on to the planned activities. Under FARIS, and this again is stakeholder management, FARIS is going to be holding 30 workshops, 60 workshops. It's 30 and 60. Altogether it's 90, but on different things. What we're aiming on this first bullet point is from the experience that we're having at the FSB, the FARIS department issues licenses to service providers. Many of them are first-time licensees. We issue them licenses. They go out there. They try to start business. Within a year, those licenses are withdrawn due to possibly lack of compliance with one or two things and serious things, and some are minor. So we have now said we are going to have to start holding workshops to try and take these people by hand pre-licensing so that they know what it means to get the license and the conditions attached to that license. Post-licensing, we also want to hold them by hand to give them a start and say, this is how you comply with the requirements of your license, so that we reduce the number of the license withdrawal. That is the aim of bullet point number one. Bullet number two is, again, under sound financial institutions, particularly insurance companies. We have now embarked on this solvency assessment management. We have to have workshops because we want to protect consumers and make sure that whatever policy they're buying policies from institutions that are financially solvent. Within the, again, on the third bullet point in the insurance division, other than the SADC involvement, and again under stakeholder management, insurance is going to be holding workshop or hosting the international workshops on a specific subcommittee of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors Worldwide. That workshop will be focusing on solvency issues, will be focusing on accounting and auditing groups and the insurance groups, reinsurance subcommittee, and supervisory cooperation subcommittee between the regulators. It's an international part of IAIS, which we are going to host in 2012. We are also going to be holding workshops with the Actuarial Society of South Africa because of the important work that they're doing, both in pensions and insurance. And again, normally on the workshops, like we said earlier, insurance will have their own industry stakeholder engagement. They'll have two of those. Pensions will have the same. Consumer education will also have the same, focusing on the teacher development workshops. Still on the same slide, when we go down to the human resources, currently FSB has got 520 employees. We plan to have 537 by the end of next year, 537. Of them, of the 520 that we currently have, we have four interns. We have also four bursaries for actuarial students. With regard to the staff as a whole, we continue doing the normal training of staff to empower them as to how to do their work. And we also have this special training for those employees that demonstrate high potential, so that we have a special training for them And this is aimed at the succession plan and, of course, the resourcing of the institution in future. And the last point we spoke about, this is knowledge management, and this is the part where we feel we haven't done much in the past, so it's a special project where we manage, we put in place a system where we will manage the knowledge that is in Jerry's head, my head, so that that knowledge gets transmitted onto the new employees of the institution. Again, we're saying it is not sufficient to have people who've been in the institution for 20 years plus, and with the knowledge they're having, if they don't share that knowledge with the young ones, we are not doing any justice to the institution and the country. So we have now put a system in place to make sure that the knowledge is shared down and disseminated to all the employees in the institution. Next slide, it's a financial implication of the budget slide that will be dealt with by Mr. Daoud.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the FSB fund itself, with regards to collection of levies from its regulated entities and service fees, we've budgeted for this next financial year a budget of 503 million, and we're budgeting in terms of our FSB expenditure 445.5 million. We're also budgeting to fund the offices of the five ombud and pension fund ombud to the value of 67.87 million. So on page 7 and 8 of our operational plan that's in front of you, we have a more detailed breakdown of what the budgets are going to be spent on in terms of both our programs, specific programs, and then on page 8, the budget breakdown is based on each goal statement or strategic objective.
Thank you, Mr. Sidat. The final slide, by way of conclusion. This whole strategic plan, Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, whilst we've put it in place with the hope that we will see its whole life, it may be interrupted actually by the coming into being of the Twin Peaks model that we are working very hard on. And of course, the proposed date of implementation of Twin Peaks, if we succeed in making sure that everything is in place by then, we're aiming at 1st of April 2013. But before that happens, legislation has to be put in place, and that legislation will be brought by National Treasury before this committee. There will be a number of pieces of legislation, but the first one that we would be looking at, Treasury will come with an overarching legislation, which will be creating this environment of Twin Peaks. After that, the peaks themselves will come again with their own operational pieces of legislation. So we're heading for a very, very busy program on this Twin Peaks. On litigation, as the minister said at the beginning, the fight continues. The main cases there are still the Fidentia matter and the Gabalas matter. There's a lot that has been written in the papers, but the fights are on. Basically, on these two cases, there are three individuals standing. Many of them have come forward, they have plead bargain, but there's still three of them standing. And it sounds like one of them is also trying to start thinking about a possible plea bargain, but of course the conditions are difficult. But with the other two, the fight is on. Both of them have applied for permanent stay of prosecution, saying the state and FSB do not have cases against them. One, a judgment is given already, he's lost the case. The case will continue. That request for permanent stay is lost. He's going to have to second one we're busy dealing with. We will, the whole of May until possibly August, we will be dealing with the second request for stay of permanent prosecution. As I said, the battle continues, and we have been called all kinds of names and all just to distract us. We have refused to be distracted. We stay on course. We deal with legal issues and don't get involved in personal issues and personal attacks. The planned legislation request for within this strategic plan, which of course will come to the committee again, from the meetings that the ministers of finance meet either under G1, G2, up to G20, and also the new FSB, International One Financial Stability Board, many issues are coming out of those sittings as a result of the financial crisis that we went through. And amongst them, questions are starting to emerge whether this whole question over the counter, the OTC derivatives, whether they should be regulated or not. But I think policy decision is taken. We need to be regulated, but you need to put it in legislation. Of course, the solvency assessment issue, SAM, for now, it's still been rolled out. We need to make an amendment in legislation to make it compulsory, otherwise it becomes voluntary. And, of course, once it's voluntary, it's got no force and effect of law. Treating customers fairly. This concept was first started in the UK, treating customers fairly. And when we started on this concept, we were told it didn't succeed in the UK. But we went and said, yes, it did not succeed because it was made optional. Here we've got to make it part of legislation. But for now, we are going to start it, disseminating it, communicating it, planning it with everybody in the industry, making sure that everything is in place. But to make sure that we succeed here, it's got to become part of legislation or regulation. In short, what does treating customers fairly mean? Treating customers fairly, in short, means that in the past, a service provider would design a product to sell to consumers. And once he's done that, if he received no complaints from consumers, he would say, this is a good product. I have received no complaints from anybody, so it must be good. Treating customers fairly changes that mentality. It's now saying, you are not only going to gauge the goodness of your product by looking at the reaction of the consumers of the product. You are going to be forced, day one, to provide or design a product that is going to be fair, so that we don't look at the consumer. We look at you to provide quality and fair product day one. Same as the regulation of credit ratings agencies. They've been operating under no legislation. And we have seen the advice that they've given to consumers or countries. Sometimes good advice, sometimes not. Now we're saying, can they be left unregulated as they're doing? Because they can do a lot of good to an economy of a country, but they can also do a lot of harm. So you need to put a framework of control for these agencies, and that piece of legislation is coming, and I've seen on the program that, in fact, it's actually coming. The same with hedge funds. At the moment, we're regulating hedge fund managers, but we've asked the question, is it sufficient to regulate the manager and not regulate what the manager is doing? The answer is we need to do both, but for that, we need legislation in place. With that, thank you very much, committee members. We'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable members, let me just take maybe 30 minutes. Okay, thank you. Honorable Ross. Honorable trapped, followed by, why do I forget your name now? Honorable Tim Harris. You'll be followed by Honorable Luyangi. Yeah, I think we just start there and end here.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to make a comment regarding the message of the chairperson regarding the unintended consequences of the perhaps displacement of financial service advisors and the concern out in practice within those businesses regarding the regulatory exams. And I think it's quite serious from the number of requests that I've received from the service advisors regarding the exams and perhaps the standard of the exams. And I quite fully understand why we should lift the bar and get to a more competent sector in terms of regulatory advising. But certainly we have the English problem. It seems that it's quite imminent, and I would like to have your views on that. We have the court case, and it will be regulated, I'm quite sure, via the Language Bill Act that will come into place. But in practice, it seems that it's very uncomfortable for some of these advisors to do the exams in Afrikaans, in English. Specifically, the Afrikaans guys seem to be battling. The pass rate of 65% in the exams, we should lift the bar, but is that reasonable? Is that what could be expected? Taking the role that these advisors should play, and I'll come to that in a minute. It's really mainly regarding legislation, and I don't think the advisors think of themselves as being a legal expert. And I think what they think they should be doing is to identify the need of the product and then do the necessary coordination with the legal experts. And I think that was the practice in the past. But of course, I realize that the basic level of competence we need to lift the bar, and I'd like to have your views on that. Chairperson, just regarding what they should be doing, what they've mentioned is that they work on retirement annuities, endowment policies, life policies, investments, and short-term insurance and medical coverage, and that they do service a lot of people out there, that they do a lot of coordination from people and identify the needs, and I think it's quite serious that we don't leave a void in this regard. Just your views on how we can solve this impasse at this point in time, and whether you are considering some extension in terms of getting these people to be fully qualified then, and the level of qualifications needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the very extensive presentation and the excellent work that the FSB does under very difficult conditions. Could I just ask you, when it comes to the regulation of your hedge fund portfolios, you indicated that the hedge fund managers are regulated, but the portfolios are not regulated. Now, what danger does that present to the financial services sector and our economy? And is it envisaged that there will be an amendment to the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act? And if so, to regulate these hedge funds' portfolios? And if so, when do you think that amendment will be brought before us? I noticed that one of your challenges is the delay in passing legislation, the time that it takes. So clearly the sooner that this portfolio committee gets that, the quicker we'll be able to look at that. Then just on the second issue of the SWOT analysis in your September document, have you been able to, and you might want to at some stage highlight the definite weaknesses that you set out a whole lot of weaknesses in page 8 of your document, and you also set out the threats. Are you able to, in a document, highlight the ways that you are dealing with those weaknesses and threats? You do touch on some of the issues, but is there any particular issue you want to raise with us that you might wish the Portfolio Committee to prioritize and assist you with? Thank you.
Thanks for the presentation. I'm interested in the time frame from where you sit for the elements of the Twin Peaks reform that's going to leave the FSB responsible for market conduct. How long do you think we have until that is in place? And do you think that that proposal or that reform is compatible with the idea that we have a single ombudsman for financial services? To me, there seems to be a contradiction there. I'm interested in the views of the FSB on whether that would be good practice in terms of a Twin Peaks model. Then the question of the old question of the surplus distribution following the conversion of from defined benefit to defined contributions over the last, it must be 30 years now. I understand that legislation was tabled to resolve the distribution around 11 years ago. Can you give us an idea of the status of the distribution? I think the numbers I saw is that initially there was around 80 billion rand outstanding, and that was brought down to around 60 billion rand last year. What is the estimate of that figure now? And the allegation last year is that there were, I think the term was political friends of various funds blocking the distribution of some very large amounts, and there were apparently two amounts being pursued by the FSB of around several hundred billion each at some time last year. So we'd like an update of the committee on the status of those distributions and whether there's still a problem with political friends blocking distribution and sidestepping the regulations. And then lastly, I've had a briefing on the one particular case in this regard. It concerns the Sable Pension Fund and the KEDAC Pension Fund. And I understand that there was a certain Mr. Tony Mostert, who was appointed acting as a curator of the Sable Pension Fund, and that fund received apparently 8 million rand in assets or more right back in 1996 from the KEDAC Pension Fund. Sorry, KEDAC received from Sable. But then after that, apparently Mr. Mostert was appointed as the curator of the KEDAC Pension Fund. Now, I believe the CEO supported that appointment. I'm interested in if that was the case. Did he support that appointment? And if so, does he believe there's a conflict of interest in Mr. Mostert acting as the curator for both of those pension funds? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson Absentia. Or the acting Chairperson, there's always a Chairperson. Mine is actually to commend FSB for this report. One thing that actually inspires me is the quantification of the planned activities. It's something, Deputy Minister, that you don't find in departments. We would always be crying foul as a committee, because in order to be able to conduct an extensive oversight over a department, you need to know about what were the plans. So on page 6, the planned activities, they are actually quantified. And you will be able now to engage even on informal basis to say, CEO, how far are you with your activity number 4? Because looking at the time. If I may just ask the person on top of that comment, which is actually as a result of why of how work has been done here. I just want to check from the FSB, in order to achieve all these objectives, you need to have warm bodies with the necessary capacity. Can you maybe breathe on that to say
in terms of your staff establishment, you have warm bodies. If you don't have, what sort of mechanism are you going to employ in terms of achieving your goals? Then always, yeah, I would also want to check the retention strategy, because what you have should always remain there. Otherwise, it's not going to work if people will look elsewhere and get greener pastures. Do you have that arrangement internally to ensure that what you have remains yours up until you actually see, now we've utilized all the expertise that you have, you can go along, but it must not be an issue that relates to, say, there's nothing that actually I'm enjoying internally.
Honorable Chabalala, you'll be followed by Madams. Are you on the list? No. Thank you for being covered. Honorable Del Van Royen, unlikely to be covered.
Thanks, Joseph. I'm not going to dwell much. I think the strategy and what is it aimed to happen is quite clear for me from where I'm sitting and the objectives and where does the FSP seek to go. I think it's very clear. But I just want to find out around the relationship with other local regulators like your BSD, NCR, SARP and so forth, that you are saying that you would want to share and to have a relationship, discuss cross-cutting issues. So I would want to find out, is the relationship mainly on information or practices or experience, or is it probably would move to some regulatory, so that there is some form of consistency around the advice of these financial institutions. I think that is my... but also on the issues of the weaknesses, I also picked up on your SWOT analysis. I just want to find out, are there any remedies that you have specific on specific weaknesses that you've covered? I mean, you've covered issues of your staff, that might be the issues of capacity. We keep on talking about capacity every time in meetings around retention strategies and so forth. I would want to speak about the exit strategy. That, you know, you keep on talking about the issue of the local content, or rather moving the information that you have with elders and seniors. Probably you must also consider the issue of the exit, so that when they exit at that time, you're able to also deal with the ones that are incoming and how you deal with the information. That's, I think it's just a comment. But from where I'm sitting, I'm happy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I should start by indicating, Chair, that I'm fully covered on the question of surplus, because I was going to ask for a status quo around the issue, and partly covered on the issue of regulatory exams. I will come on that one. Chair, very quickly, I can see that on the official sign off sheet, the executive officer didn't attach the signature. I don't know. What are the reasons? But I also wanted to check if does it not have any effect on the credibility of the report, of the plan, in fact. And then on the issue of the G20 leaders agreeing that all the over-the-counter that the derivatives should now be obviously traded on the exchange. What is, I mean, we are a developing country, so one is very much interested to know the impact of such an agreement on our developmental agenda, you know. And, you know, last in our engagement, we did raise sharply the issue of curatorship, and I thought I was not going to raise it now, but there are two developments that are really pushing me to raise. The first one is the issue of the Aurora liquidator
saga. You remember Mr. Mutala? Yeah, a case, I hope we all know that at some stage, I mean, liquidators were referring to Mr. Mutala, a person who's monopolizing the field. And the second issue is the case, I think there is a case on the curator challenging FSB, because FSB, I think, in the court was saying that, no, we are happy with your services. And the curator took the matter to court and said, no, but I don't think I'm done on this matter. So it really confused me. But it, if you remember, I mean, how we phrased our question in our last engagement, we said there is a tendency that people might prolong their stay as curators. How do you manage that, you know? Now, this issue of a curator taking FSB to court, to me, was very interesting, you know. But now, maybe what we need to do, Chair, because now it's becoming very apparent to us to follow on the trends around this issue, because now it will obviously involve a lot of issues, even empowerment aspects. How many times has Mr. Mostert given opportunity to serve as a curator? I mean, how long does it take to conclude on some of these cases referred to him? I think such questions really to us are very important, because we want to see the FSB also playing a role in terms of ensuring that we empower our people appropriately. Maybe the request that one to make on this case, Chair, is can we get a detailed report separately from the strat plan indicating how many cases are handled, and also what are the dynamics around these cases, so as we are able to follow on this matter. That's a request, Chair. And you know, to me, it's a very good intervention, because I know, I mean, how many of our financial brokers are bit, one can term unscrupulous, are so engaged in unscrupulous practices. And I know most of our people have been suffering because of that. So this intervention of regulatory exams, to me, really, as someone who's concerned about our people on the ground, is a much-needed intervention. I think the question that I will have is not a language question, because when we go to language question, I might also, I can open it up and say, yeah, I mean, but also the majority of our people also do have a problem with your English language, or maybe do have a problem with African language, you know, so they might also not pass this test, you know, because of the language barrier. But it's as correctly summed up here, it's a matter that the court will decide. And my issue is, which standards are we benchmarking? Are we using to benchmark, I mean, the whole, what you call, approach? Because to me, we must be using standards that will not going to end on our competitiveness. We must be using standards that are not going to compromise, I mean, the recognition that we are currently enjoying globally, you know? So I'll be very much excited if we get the background of what is informing this, the structure of this examination, you know. But I must reiterate, from my side, as someone who's concerned with the majority of the people on the ground, this is a much welcome intervention. You are South African Council of Churches special project. Thank you, because we really raise it, and we think that this is the right approach in terms of educating our people. But I'm not sure how I'm going to assess the impact. Because at times, I mean, for us to start realizing the impact of such, it will take time. And we want this thing to happen to other provinces, you know. So I'm not sure how are you going to balance this assessment and the need that is there already. Because as we have already suggested as a committee, I mean, our people need to be educated around financial matters, you know. So I will appreciate if I get to know how are you going to assess the impact of this intervention. Lastly, no, I think, have I exhausted my questions? Okay, yeah. The only indication on the King 3 report compliance, a gap analysis that was done and referred to the board, I mean, for the board to discuss and take a decision. Is there any outcome of that board meeting? Because this, it was referred in 2010, according to your plan. Is there any feedback around the gap analysis conducted, and how are those going to be dealt with? Thank you very much.
Thank you, honorable members. Back to you, Deputy Minister, and your team.
Perhaps before the chief executive responds, I will beg for your indulgence in terms of protection of the chief executive in responding to some of the matters that are before the court, so that the committee understands if we are measured in giving details to some of the matters. I would just request that we. And then there is also a question with regards to the time frames with regards to the implementation of the Twin Peaks. This committee will just bear with us that once the technicalities are dealt with, it will come before this committee. It will entirely depend as soon as it is before this committee, because there will be legislative amendments that kick in that the committee will be dealing with. So it's a matter that once it is before the committee, it will be much easier to identify that. But it's a matter that is receiving our fullest attention. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Committee members again. I'm going to allocate the questions to the team. The regulatory exam questions.
Just to remind you that as you do the allocation, bear in mind of the fact that we are almost 15 minutes to 1 o'clock.
We will be short with the answers, I hope, but there may be other questions that may require slightly few minutes extra. The regulatory exam, I think it's an important question. Jerry Anderson will deal with that. Jerry will also deal with the hedge funds issues. The weaknesses, I'll deal with that. The minister has already dealt with the time frame on Twin Peaks. Surplus distribution, surplus issues, I'll deal with that quickly. Political funds issue, I'll also deal with that. Warm bodies, Jerry will deal with that. Regulatory relationships, I'll deal with that. And OTC, Jerry, FACC, Jerry and I will deal with that. And King 3 Code, Mr. Sidat will deal with that. Thank you. Let me deal with those that require my attention. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Advice Minister. Let me start off by the question number 5. It deals with the surplus issues. Initially, indeed, the 80 billion rand was splashed around the newspapers in the country, but truth of the matter is that was just an estimation from the chief actuary of the FSB at the time. The real figure didn't, it wasn't that high. This is why over time we have come down to a realistic figure of about 60 billion rand. The update as of now, I think almost 40 billion rand has been distributed. There's still some amounts outstanding to be distributed, and those amounts that are not distributed yet are linked to the question of the allegation of political friends. And of course, the political friends and the Sable and KDEC matters, also they all linked in there, because remember this case, it's not about people having taken normal benefits from funds. Normal benefits were paid. Nothing wrong with the normal. It's about the dissipation of surpluses from pension funds. The issue of the political friends, it was around allegations made by one individual saying that there is a 750 million rand which has been recovered, which is hidden somewhere. Only two people know about that 750 million rand, where that money is. And those two people, according to this individual,
those two people who knew where the 750 million was the curator, Mr. Mostert, and myself, trying to suggest that we have taken the 750 million ourselves. And to try and mislead the public on that, they went and appointed a private investigator who went and said, because of the disappearance of the 750 million rand, that Mostert has got that property costing that much, and that Chidi has got that property costing that much, all bought for cash. These are allegations that are given by an individual, and of course using political connections. Subsequent to that, some people were feeling FSB must rebut this in the media and so on. We refrained from doing that because, as I said earlier, when people want to deflect you from dealing with issues legally, don't allow that. Instead, we issued a PF circular, a circular that went to everybody's dealing with the 750 million rand. The 750 million rand indeed is there, but it is invested with three credible institutions. That information was given, and no reaction has been given to the media by the very person who's been making those allegations. Right? That is the political issue. Then comes the issue of Sable, KDEC, Mostert being the curator, and the executive officer approving it. Sorry. And, of course, I want to cover also the issue of Mostert being appointed over and over and over as a curator. I hope we clear this once for all. It is not true that Mostert has been appointed over and over and over as a curator. Mostert is a curator of the Gavala's option issue, which involves a number of funds. He's dealing with one issue which unfortunately has got a number of funds. It's not like he was appointed for this fund, for that fund. No, he was appointed once for this option, and that is what he's dealing with. So there's no question of Mostert being favored and being appointed many times to at the expense of possible other people. Then comes the issue of KDEC, the KDEC pension fund. We will know that this individual I'm referring to, and I'm not mentioning him because we are before the court. This individual, we're before the court with him. This individual is facing fraud and criminal charges relating to the dissipation of surpluses. Right? Now, the criminal process started. The funding on those the funding to the lawyers who are defending this individual, the funding was paid from a fund, KDEC pension fund, which has got nothing to do with this criminal case. When that came to the attention of the regulator through an inspection, through an investigation conducted by the regulator, that fund was also put under curatorship. Right? Again, as part of the Gavala's issue, because there's monies that are out of that. Now, the issue of conflict started when this KDEC pension fund was placed under curatorship. And why it was put under curatorship? It was made to make sure that assets of that particular fund don't fund criminal cost charges that have got nothing to do with it. That's why it was put under curatorship. Of course, it's part of Gavala. Now, because Mostert was also a part of that, was made the curator of that fund, suddenly there was an issue of there must be a conflict of interest here. Let's not lose sight of one fact. No pension fund is before the courts. It is an individual who is before the court. And there is no conflict between anybody being charged criminally and any pension fund.
the fallacy of conflict of interest does not exist, but it is before the courts. The court will decide as to whether there's a conflict, but we are saying we are dealing with an individual who's before the court and not a pension fund. Still on that, let me deal with the issue of the curator refusing or taking the FSB to court where the FSB want to terminate a curatorship. Right. In this matter, the curatorship has been there for many years. True. That's a fact. It's been going on and on and on. But that on and on must be qualified. Why is it going on and on? It's because there's a lot of litigation around that fund. And the parties that are involved, the parties that are taken to task, are defending. And, of course, the key witnesses to all this litigation around this particular case are the very people who initially laid their hands on the assets of that fund. Now, you can imagine, they're not going to go forward and say, we will willingly come and give evidence. Of course, they must be compelled to come. That's another legal process, right? And, of course, there are two big institutions that are involved here, serious, serious institutions in the country that must be taken to task. Those institutions are not going to walk meekly to the guillotine and say, chop our head off, we've taken the money. It's not going to happen. Who is going to deal with that litigation but the curator? If you terminate curatorship, you are actually saying those institutions must walk, because no one is going to take those institutions to task because of the collusion between the original trustees and those institutions. Give you an example what I'm talking about. You will all recall the demutualization exercise of the two big institutions. Some of the funds were administered by those big institutions. When shares were allocated, one of this particular fund was also allocated shares. Those shares amounted to over, in money terms, then 200 million rand. Of course, this money was taken to an institution and say, if we give you this money to invest for us, how much kickback are you going to give to us? The institution said, keep the money, I'll give you X kickback. But remember, this kickback that I'm giving, it's not a gift. I will keep the money for X number of years. The growth on that money from now on is mine. Because in a way, I'm giving you the growth upfront by way of kickback. How can we let a case like that disappear? Pursuing cases like that, of course, it's going to take time. And once it takes time, people are not going to think that litigation on this important matter is taking time. They're going to say, but this curatorship is going forever. The curators are holding on. They don't want to release. It's not like that. Finally, we said, all right, we know there's this litigation. Let's bring this curatorship to an end and have other people coming in to run this fund. But the question came, who? Who is going to do that? The issue was, let's get independent people now to come and run this fund. But of course, people wanted to, the very people who were there in the past wanted to come back and run the fund. The curator said, as an officer of court, I will be irresponsible to hand this fund back to the same people that raided the fund in the first place. But they were adamant. And whilst we were trying to find a way out, because we also want to have that curatorship come to an end, but of course, independent people, then there was a challenge from the very people. Of course, if there's a legal challenge, the matter goes to court. Up to now, we're waiting for the judgment from the court. The matter has been to court, but we're waiting for judgment. I can tell you here that those people, it's a 50-50 issue. We will wait for the judgment, but it was not an easy case. Having dealt with that, now move on quickly to the issue of the relationships with other regulators.
Okay, I hope you appreciate the effect of litigation having the potential to distract us from what we are about. As we have seen how much time the chief executive has spent, and as Desert originally said, perhaps there should be just an update which says to the committee, these are the cases that are before the courts. But he gets passionate, and that is why we have a chief executive who is a lawyer at the helm of the FSB, because that's how it works. But I think the committee appreciates that. I mean, it would be very difficult to be able to give a comprehensive answer on this matter.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. The other issue that I said I was going to deal with is the relationship between the regulators. Yeah. There are structures in place for the regulators to work together. Fortunately, we've always had ministers of finance who had one belief in their mind that there is what they always called the financial family. In that family, they bring all the regulators together to share information and all that. And also in the Twin Peaks coming, there's going to be a tool that will formalize the cooperation between the regulators. But all in all, the cooperation is wonderful. The South African Council of Churches, Jerry will deal with that. The King Code gap analysis. The gap analysis, the draft is done, but it has posed problems. And the problems are sometimes people tend to think they understand things when they actually don't. King 1, 2, 3, it's meant for companies to comply with for good corporate governance. One issue that must be kept in mind is one, FLB is not a company. We are not a company, therefore not compelled at all to comply with King 3. However, if there are good things that can be taken out and picked up from the King 3, which will enhance the good corporate governance of the FSB, that will be done. So we're looking at the analysis. And, of course, we will take that. Now, there are a number of instruments that we must look at. King 3, we must look at King 3. Thirdly, we must look at the FSB Act. Thirdly, our Bible as the FSB is the PFMA Act, Public Finance Management Act. That is our tool. Therefore, that analysis on its own must be looked vis-a-vis the PFMA Act. Because where there's contradiction or conflict, for us, PFMA Act will always be the Bible to follow. That's how far we are with that. The rest, Jerry, quickly, and Dawood. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. I'll go fast, having cognizance of the time. Regulatory examinations. Everybody's view is, there's not going to be a displacement of financial service advisors. But that's a negative message. The positive message is the 110,000 representatives and the 13,000 key individuals must go and write the exam before the final date of 30 November. They also then have a chance of 3 months extension, 3 months to rewrite. That's And if everybody has that positive mindset, that it will be done. The indications are that we're getting there. We've got in our examination bodies, we've got the facility, the capacity chair. The regulatory exams, there's confusion about what it entails. The first one entails knowledge of the Act. I always use this analogy, and it might sound stupid. If you want a firearm, you have to have knowledge of the Firearm Act. If you want to operate in terms of the FICE Act, which was adopted by this Parliament in 2002, we found that nobody knows what their obligations are under the Act. They don't comply. So that was why in 2008 the regulatory exams were introduced. So the first component is knowledge of the Act. That's what we're talking about now only.
The second component, which hasn't been started yet because we want to see how the first component, is knowledge of particular financial product if you haven't got certain other formal qualification, which you will get exempt from. Chair, I think it's member Ross was talking about a 65% pass rate. It's a multiple choice question. And the 65% pass rate, we were advised by our panel of examination experts that this is the way we should go. The FSB is a responsible organization. We will not be the cause. Whatever the decisions that are going to be made, we will not be the cause of thousands of people or even hundreds of people losing their jobs. Just on the Afrikaans, after we agreed to make the examination at great cost available, the opponents representing the Afrikaans community still proceeded to take us to court. We were 2 days in court in February. They withdrew the case after listening to our evidence to the judge. So that's where we are. And the Afrikaans, the examinations in Afrikaans were introduced in the beginning of April after the piloting and the trialing of the questions. Mr. Sidat.
Chair, on our weaknesses and our threats in our SWOT analysis, That was the basis on which we used to prepare our strat plan for the next 5 years. And what we did, it's something that maybe I've realized we can add a column for the next report, is to indicate where we address each weakness and threat that we identified. And if we had time, I'll take you through each one and tell you where in our strat plan session or where in this objective plan we've tried to address them. There are some of them that we've realized are beyond our control, but we keep looking for opportunities to try and address them. Most of the threats will be addressed in our stakeholder engagements, people that we can't control, but we can influence or at least let them understand our opinions. So that's what we've done. But in terms of our weaknesses, this is where we're putting extra special investments to try and reduce them or mitigate them or remove them altogether.
Chair, quickly on the hedge funds, the OTC, I think the gentleman was identified, honourable member, Mr. Swartz, is that correct? We will bring the management of hedge fund portfolios under regulation of the current Collective Investment Schemes Act. However, when the Collective Investment Schemes Act gets reviewed, probably by next year, it will be incorporated in the Act. Why is it necessary? Because of the concentration and the leverage that we want to manage. A normal collective investment scheme, there are 5% and 10% limits. We need to look at hedge funds and funds of hedge funds in the same light and see what is going to be good so that a pension fund one individual can purchase it like a normal collective investment scheme today. On the OTCs, we are looking at reporting structure. This is one of the things that came out of the financial crisis, and it's an international, regulators have been asked to look at introduction of some type of oversight of OTCs, shares that are not traded on the market and usually not listed. I think that's it.
There's still two more outstanding. The first one is the warm bodies because of all this strategic document and whether we end their tension strategies and all that. In this financial sector, it is mighty difficult to get skills because we all fighting for the same cake. as an industry. What we have done at the FSB, we believe in the internal promotions. We promote people as soon as they perform well, and we feed in from the bottom. We take people straight from the university. We prepare them ourselves. It takes time, but we hold them by hand. So that otherwise, we're trying to address this issue of qualified and graduate who are sitting there. If we can move people upwards and feed in from the bottom, that's what we are doing. But of course, from time to time, you get somebody from outside. How do we retain people? We believe that to retain people, they've got to see value in being in the institution. And that value cannot come in terms of money, but it will only come in terms of how you care for the employees, how you train them. And of course, in the care and training on themselves may not be enough, but you must also make sure that the institution itself, it's a reputable institution. People must be proud to be associated with the institution. And that's what we are, those three things that are helping us to have retain people and have people staying with us. The other outstanding matter, the final one, is the how we're going to manage the gauge the success of our relationship with the South African Council of Churches. As we said earlier, we're training people from the council so that they go out there with our FSB people. The whole idea is to make sure that the message gets onto the people from the pulpit, not from the FSB, from the pulpit. Every Sunday we want ministers to preach and tell people on how to manage finances. But how do you do that without something tangible? We have identified a specific issue for starters, because this is a project, a pilot project in Gauteng. We have specifically targeted at the massive expenditure on funerals for this project. We say people are spending a lot of money on funerals. Some even spend money that they don't even have. We put poor families under pressure to buy this and this to cater for people who are supposed to come and support them. The whole thing has turned around. People come to be supported. We say, how do you manage money? Burying the dead should be just for that. Let's keep the money for the education of the children who are remaining behind. That we will be able to see the change in mentality on the funeral expenses for this project pilot. That will be tangible, and we want to see. One church has already taken a decision. Come funeral day, simple, dignified coffin. Sandwich is tea. Thank you, goodbye. No other expenses. That is what we want to achieve with this project, and if we succeed there, we will be having enough ammunition to spread our wings throughout the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that complains about too little meat on the plate.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to talk to softer issues, just two or so, because we don't have much time. It is one, I fully appreciate the initiative with the South African Council of Churches, because it was a committee proposal in the first instance. But also the fact that on compliance matters, your role is now expanding in the sense that you would want to handhold those who seek to be active in the sector. Therefore, creating an enabling environment, which is putting a lot of responsibility on your side. And I would want to imagine that program is also underpinned by one of the most important pillars of transforming society. That new entrance
which is linked to the sector charter issues, transformation in this financial sector. I think it is very, very important that as we do all these things, we don't lose sight of that aspect. And probably at some point, would want to have a sense of what role do you play in that area to ensure that transformation takes place in the financial sector, particularly in the insurance industry. Very, very critical. Not undermining what Mr. Van Ron or Honorable Van Ron has said in terms of our international credibility, ratings, and so on and so forth. I think that's one point that I wanted to make. Another softer issue relates to this thing of the meat is too small in a funeral. I think it's important that the public institutions, not just the churches, should actually continue to talk about the importance of savings and making sure that we don't overspend. But I want probably you to match that against service providers, because what I see on TV, immediately after Morning Live, and that program, I think, is very biased. It's very, very biased. It presuggests that there is a certain race group in this country. Perhaps there is an element of truth in that, but I don't just think it is correct the way it is actually being projected. This Africans in Soweto, in some rural village and all those kind of things, as if they are the only ones who are affected by this kind of product. Now, if you are issuing licenses, one of the things that you have said to us is that the service provider has a responsibility to educate. It's not your responsibility. And I think they must be held accountable for that. It can't be this clientele thing. It was first the mobile telephones, Yewo Gog and all these kind of things. Fine. And some ringtones, you know. Now, it has been replaced by this after news slot, where you just find all sorts of insurance companies projecting some Africans to be the ones who are affected by all sorts of things. Now, I think it would be important that that issue is addressed, together with the SABC, by the way. It's not just an issue for the FSB. We would want to appreciate your intervention, Deputy Minister, that legal cases, matters that are sub judice, will just get information but not delve into those issues. It's very tempting to go into the details because we are lobbied, you know, and that's the issue here. We get lobbied for all sorts of things and would want to push certain particular positions. But I think we should congratulate the FSB for being firm, because you have to be beyond reproach to do this job. And up to now, I think you have done a very, very good job and a sterling job in that area. And continue. It's not going to be an easy. You're fighting all sorts of people with very big pockets, deep pockets, and they use those resources that they've accumulated in a wrong way to fight a legitimate institution. And I think at some point, Parliament should also raise its voice to protect this institution. I think with those few words, and because of time, Deputy Minister, your team, and honorable members, let's call it for a day, for now, let's call it a day. We will convene for the next presentations. I'm told it's Tuesday next week. It doesn't mean that we are off. There are documents that we should go through. There are other subcommittees or ad hoc committees that we should be participating in. Let's not extend the long weekend. You know, you'll find difficulties to readjust to come back to work. Thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you, Deputy Minister.
Huh?